commercial whale watching, briefing, and public hearing. Dr. Julie Watson, please.
Promoted her. I don't know why she wasn't, her panelist link wasn't working, but she gave it a second.
Hi, everyone. I will share my slides here. Wonderful. Can everyone see those okay?
Yeah, it looks good.
Thank you. Thanks, Chair Carpenter and Commission. My name's Julie Watson, and I'm here talking to you for the third time. The first time was last December, and then you most recently saw me in September talking about this issue. And in September, we really dug in on the process to form commercial whale watching rules. And today I'm going to dig in more deeply into the content of those proposed rules, as well as the science and the economic analysis that informed those proposals. I have a lot of slides, and I know that there are quite a few people already signed up to speak, so I'm going to go quickly. Some slides will be there for reference, and you can refer to them. There's also a ton more information in your packets, and please feel free to ask me questions about any of those materials. I will stop and hone in on some points that I want to make really clear during the presentation, but of course, feel free to cut me off as needed. So a couple quick updates. The population of SRKW stands at 74 in wild. We had two new births in September, which was really exciting. Last news was that those calves are both doing well. Orca Recovery Day was in October, and the governor tweeted about our progress on the task force recommendations. I wanted to bring this up because there were 49 task force recommendations, and progress is being made on a lot of them. And we issued this letter that I have a little screenshot of down in the corner, summarizing state agency progress on a lot of those recommendations. So today we're going to talk about commercial whale watching, which is one piece of one of the threats, vessel disturbance and noise, of the broader Southern Resident Recovery effort. And lots of things are happening in those other areas too. So I want you to have the takeaway point that we're not putting the whole pressure of recovery of this species on this one issue. Southern residents have been struggling. Historic populations were as high as the 200s, and the capture era really decimated the population. They bounced back a bit and then started to decline again. Were listed endangered in the states and then federally in the early 2000s, and have kind of continued that decline since then. Main threats are prey availability, vessel disturbance and noise, and contaminants in their prey and in the water around them. So, like I said, we're focusing in on one piece of the vessel issue today. The task force had those 49 recommendations. There were several bills passed in 2019 to address some of the initial task force recommendations. The one highlighted in red there, Second Substitute Senate Bill 5577, is the bill that authorized and directed the department to do this work. Among other things in that bill, including changing the distance and speed regulations for all boats around southern resident killer whales, it directed the departments to administer a new commercial whale watching license that is required for commercial whale watch operators. It defined fees, and most importantly for our discussion today, it requires CFW to adopt rules for license holders and how they can view southern resident killer whales. There were some definitions in the bill. I'm not going to go into these, but I wanted to call your attention to the little sticky note there. Commercial whale watching means taking or offering to take, so advertising in some way that you're potentially going to see whales on a trip. So taking passengers for a fee, if whale watching happens on that trip, then that is commercial whale watching. So we call that incidental whale watching, and that means that fishing charters that take advantage of opportunities to view whales with their passengers when they come up would need a license and would be following these rules that you guys end up adopting as well. The department must adopt rules for holders of the license for the viewing of southern resident orca whales in the inland waters of Washington by January 1. So we're coming down to the wire here on adopting rules, which is why this is in front of you today. And you're scheduled to make a decision on the 18th. the legislation was really clear about what those rules needed to do and some of the things that we absolutely had to consider doing in the restrictions. So the rules must be designed to reduce daily and cumulative impacts on southern resident orca whales and consider the economic viability of license holders. And then below there, you can see that we were told to consider putting restrictions on the number of operators that could view southern residents at once, the days and hours of operation, the duration spent in the vicinity of whales, and the areas in which operators can operate. And an interesting piece of that is that you'll notice that two of those refer to southern resident orcas specifically. The other two, B and D, are more general. So the idea is still to provide benefit to southern resident orca whales by reducing daily and cumulative impacts, but that might include restricting beyond just when whales are actively present. These rules, proposed rules are couched within a broader context of vessels. So there are broader vessel regulations for viewing marine mammals. I've listed some of those here. It filters down to the licensing program, fees, and requirements. Some of the pieces of the proposed rules in front of you are just codifying how we'll administer that license. But really, this fine points at the bottom of the funnel here, we're honing in on rules for license holders' viewing of SRKW. And then really what we need to hit is this target in the middle. The rules must be designed using best available science to reduce daily and cumulative impacts and consider the economic viability. Outside of that, that second ring, we need these rules to be implementable, enforceable, measurable, and able to be adaptively managed because there are requirements that we measure these rules and their effectiveness and report back to the legislature. And finally, we know that this isn't happening in a vacuum, and so we're thinking about that bigger picture of how this relates to the other vessel-related issues. There will be lots of comments later. We've received a lot of public comments on the influence of commercial whale watch operators on recreational boaters and their role in relation to commercial shipping and Navy activities. And so that's something we're thinking about. But more than anything, we have to hit that center bullseye of this diagram. So this process started over a year ago, and the first phase that I talked to you about in our last presentation was the process of getting input before we issued draft rules. So that involved a lot of getting ideas and public input, involved economic analysis, two different economic analyses I'll talk about, and assembling the best available science. And now today, as of October 21st, we've published two alternatives as draft rules under consideration. And we're moving into this final phase where we finalize the rules and publish them into the WAC. That process, again, this is one I'll glaze over. The input process involved an advisory committee that met from January through July, an intergovernmental coordination group that we've been checking in with along the way that involves state, federal, and local and international governments helping guide the process, particularly guiding our engagement of the advisory committee. An independent science panel managed by the Washington State Academy of Sciences, a SEPA analysis, and two economic analyses, and a whole process to developing the licensing infrastructure internally at DFW. Okay, so I'm going to go into a little depth here on the science because this is really important. The legislation said the department must use the best available science in the establishment of the Southern Resident orca whale watching rules and continue to adaptively manage the program using the most current and best available science. So I'm summarizing some of the key findings from the science panel. So this panel was recruited by the Washington State Academy of Sciences. They ran all of their meetings. They had some stakeholder and science workshops along the way, and then they issued this final report at the end of August. Here are some of their main findings. Close approaches by vessels can cause significant direct effects on foraging, and vessel presence, not just sound, can cause changes in orca behavior. Close approaches of boats can cause indirect negative effects, including masking, elevated noise levels that interfere with communication and foraging, even slow-moving vessels. And the way I like to explain this is if you remember what it was like to go to crowded restaurants and you'd have to raise your voice to talk to your friend across the table, that's what we're talking about here with masking. Behavioral responses to noise and disturbance, such as, well, I guess that goes with this point as well. Behavioral responses to noise and disturbance, such as increased surface active behaviors or changes in vocalizations, can increase and energy expenditure. Start here at the top again. Determining the impacts of whale watching vessels is complicated by the scope and context of many studies to date, including study age, and that there are an array of different threats. So the science panel recognizes this and recognizes the need for adaptive management and ongoing studies. And some of those studies are ongoing currently. But again, they pulled back with the using best available science, which sometimes did look at other species as it applies to potentially this management context. The science panel was applying that as best as they can given the current availability of science. So reduced individual foraging success due to vessels may in turn result in reduced survival and fecundity that may result in population level effects. Lactating females and calves are likely the most susceptible to the consequences of reduced foraging. Chinook prey abundance has a greater effect on SRKW population growth rates than vessel noise and disturbance. However, SRKW reduce foraging behavior in the presence of vessels regardless of prey availability. Okay, last page on this. Strike risk is not zero, and the risk of injury or mortality increases with vessel speed. Data gaps include understanding of the chronic effects of whale watching activities on SRKW foraging success under current management, and of the extent that reduced foraging success translates into the growth or decline for SRKW population. And here's the big takeaway from the science panel. They said, given the fragile condition of the SRKW population, the committee considers the precautionary approach to management of known stressors to be justified. The committee recommends defining every interaction with SRKW as an opportunity to disturb a whale. And they said even a low number of 3 to 5 vessels can cause impacts to SRKW. So two other big conclusions. I'll focus on the bolded text on the left. Slowing boats and decreasing time around whales, as well as increasing the distance from whales, are considered the primary means to reduce noise levels. And because you have heard and will hear a lot more today about the sentinel role of commercial whale watch operators, they reviewed a study that was put together to try to analyze whether there is a sentinel effect, and they concluded that it wasn't sufficient to demonstrate scientific evidence of a sentinel role. So they said there is insufficient evidence for a positive sentinel effect of commercial whale watching. This topic needs further study. And so what we've built into the rules is that opportunity to further study the potential sentinel role of commercial whale watch vessels. Another piece, that other core piece of our directive here, was to consider the economic viability. So that looks at whether the direct compliance costs or reduction in ticket sales will result in profitability being reduced to zero. We contracted with a firm that has worked on other killer whale issues to do the economic analysis. They looked at the different industries. You can see here that it highlights potential for impact. Of course, the primary whale watch industry is the group that was most likely to be impacted by direct compliance costs. However, at the end of the day, what that analysis identified is that there were only a few factors that could affect viability. And those include purchase of AIS during the COVID downturn. AIS is a GPS tracking unit for boats, essentially. Hiring something that requires hiring new and additional staff, or closures, geographic closures beyond the existing no-go zone. So those were the only factors called out that could potentially affect viability. And I want you to note that viewing SRKW, anything to do with restricting viewing SRKW, is not included because the industry estimates that SRKW are viewed on less than 10% of tours. Also, you should note that this bottom graph kind of shows with the increase in number of vessels, that blue line, the industry was growing up until 2018. And the decline in the last 2 years was attributed by folks in the industry to potentially negative press regarding their impact on SRKW and the COVID economic downturn, respectively. So this is an important graph because it really hones in on what were we trying to balance here. There's a lot of things that we're trying to balance, and it's important to note that everything in the proposed rules is there for a very specific reason, and everything not in the proposed rules was left out for a specific reason. The draft response or summary and response to comments kind of goes into some of those reasons both ways, but this graph summarizes it. We had to meet the conservation objective using best available science. And what we, our big takeaways there is that we needed to limit the days and hours that commercial whale watch boats, motorized vessels particularly, are within a half nautical mile of SRKW, and we needed to be precautionary, identifying every opportunity to disturb a whale. And we worked with our wildlife biologists in wildlife diversity and identified that in a limited season, with not more than around 4 hours a day of viewing opportunity, we could meet that conservation goal. And we were really focusing on providing more uninterrupted time where they could forage and rest and socialize undisturbed. And I'll note that undisturbed is narrowly focusing on this piece of the puzzle that we're dealing with, commercial whale watch vessels. That doesn't mean that there won't be other vessels around. And that's why I was trying to couch that this is part of a much bigger effort to look at the overall vessel issue. The science also encouraged us to take extra caution with calves. Beyond that, the enforcement and administration pieces were really important, and we worked very closely with enforcement to try to come up with measures that could be enforced. So some of the things we heard from enforcement is that if we had things that were too complicated or variable, it would be hard for them to enforce that, and it would be hard to ensure that the folks on the water understood the rules. They're also pretty concerned about needing to be out there with a stopwatch timing every boat as it entered and left a certain vicinity. And they were worried about their staffing capacity to do that while they manage all their other responsibilities on the water. Finally, although the economic analysis did not point to limiting SRKW viewing as a potential negative economic impact on the industry, we did want to allow opportunity once we were certain that those other two bubbles were met. And so we focused the opportunity we are proposing to allow on the high season for whale watching. We heard feedback that they wanted more of the year available to view. The industry wanted to be able to view southern residents during more of the year. And so we created this option B that I'll present to you today as well. And we've heard from the industry that they care a lot about what they call their sentinel role and how they can impact recreational boats. And so we also chose days and times where there might be other high recreational traffic, and we can observe and study that sentinel role so we can adaptively manage the rules based on what we learn. So this timeline, it's been ongoing since spring of 2019. There's a lot of moving pieces. We're now at the hearing today. The final EIS will be coming out soon, and your scheduled decision is on the 18th. I'll loop back to this slide at the end and leave it up if that's helpful for you. We've now moved beyond that input process to this next phase of finishing the CEPA EIS, getting more public comments. The public comment period is open through tomorrow at 5 p.m. and we'll be taking quite a few public comments today during this meeting. And of course, your decision before we finalize these rules. So diving into the rules, we are proposing potential restrictions in a lot of these different categories. And you can see that these do match pretty well with what we were directed to do and directed to consider in the legislation. And I'll focus in on all of these independently. So first here, the biggest part of the discussion is the differences between A and B, which I believe I've highlighted in the dark blue there in the bottom left. I'll come to that last. There are also the ones in blue here that are highlighted kind of in the middle are in both packages. So I'll start by talking about those. I'm not going to spend time talking about the administrative components, though I'm happy to help answer questions about those. I will, though, before we dive in, talk about a couple key definitions that are important for understanding how the rules would play out. these are some of those definitions. I'm going to illustrate them so I won't linger on this page for long. AIS, I've already defined a vicinity instance, going from the bottom up. Vicinity instance is amount of time spent near SRKW, and we've defined vicinity specifically. We've also defined, because it's vicinity of a group of southern resident killer whales, we had to define a group as well. So I'll start with that one. So we've got in the background here a map of the San Juan Islands. That's where a lot of the kind of center point of this activity has been taking place, and a lot of the community we've been involved in. The west side of San Juan Island here in the bottom left, again, is a high point and historical foraging area for SRKW. So pretend we have these two groups of whales. You've got one here, and the other one's kind of spread out around it. What I've drawn there is a bubble of a mile in either direction, so a mile radius or 2 miles, and you can see that I've highlighted the scale at the bottom there. So this is fairly close to scale. So this is one group of whales. Say you've got this other group of whales that is over here, and you can see that whale, though the bubbles overlap, none of the whales are in that group are within the bubble of a whale in the other group. That's the important piece here. So this is two groups of whales. If that whale swam now into that radius of the other group, now it is within that group. That means it's part of that group. And you can see that that has cascading effects. So those groups have now merged. Hopefully that makes sense. If a whale decides to jump out ahead and move more than a mile away from the closest whale to it, it is now its own separate group of whales. And that's important because one of the things we're defining is the number of boats that can be around a group of whales at once. So if you have two groups or one group, that changes the total number of boats viewing at one time. Okay, vicinity is the other important definition I wanted to hone in on. It's a half nautical mile radius. So looking here at this little whale, you've already got that little dotted line around it that shows the distance rules that everyone must follow. So 300 yards to the sides, 400 front and back. All boats must stay that far away. Vicinity then adds this bubble, this now orange bubble, of a half nautical mile in all directions from that whale. And you can see all of these have that little vicinity bubble around them, and they kind of join together. So within the vicinity, you can see I have two little boats that just entered the scene here. The one that's in orange next to our little example whale is within the vicinity of that group of whales. That other gray boat, it's more than a half mile away from any of those whales in that group, so it's not in the vicinity. Hopefully that makes sense. Happy to come back to it though. Focusing in on rule elements that are in both options that we've brought to you. There are some general SRKW focused rules. There's a closed area. There's some restrictions specific to non-motorized whale watchers that were called out specifically as needing a license and participating in whale watching. There's compliance and reporting requirements, and there are penalties defined. This is a reference graph. I'm going to use these next slides instead of this one, but feel free to come back to this if you'd like. The SRKW, so a license is needed for all whale watching in Washington State, but these SRKW rules focus on the inland waters of Washington, and that's what this map shows. The geographic restriction we're proposing is an existing voluntary no-go zone that goes from Mitchell Bay to Cattle Point on the west side of San Juan Island, extending a quarter mile offshore, but a half mile from the Limekiln Lighthouse. So this is a no-go zone. The industry has supported this in the past, and it's in their guidelines for their association, those that are in the association, to follow this voluntarily. We're proposing formalizing this and not expanding it. The reason we didn't expand it is because we were concerned about the Coast Guard feedback that might push vessels into the shipping lanes in a way that they were nervous about. This, making that a permanent no-go zone for commercial whale watch vessels mirrors what Canada is doing. They have 3 interim sanctuaries right now that they're still measuring and adaptively managing. And those are in red. So Swiftsure and then Pender and Saturna Islands each also have a interim sanctuary zone is what they're calling them up there. Our guidelines we propose for kayaks, a lot of these come straight from what's called the Kayak Education and Leadership Program, or KELP. The guide is responsible for the vessels on the tour. There's no positioning in the path of an SRKW. And if SRKW come upon a group of kayaks, they should raft up, which means group together and get as close to shore or in a kelp bed if possible. Something to note here, the one thing that we expanded a bit was a launch restriction when SRKW are within a half mile. It's hard to get human-powered vessels out of the way once they're in the water because they just can't move as fast as vessels with engines. However, we can limit them getting in the water if we know SRKW are right in the general vicinity where they would be launching. So that was our idea for human-powered vessels. Compliance and reporting. We want to log and measure all of this so we can adaptively manage it. We're asking that in both versions of the rules that AIS be installed on all vessels. This costs around $1,000, AIS Class B, specifically Class A is more expensive. Class A is also already required by the Coast Guard on all vessels that are above a certain size. Half of the commercial whale watching fleet already falls within that requirement and already has AIS on board. The other half we would request also get AIS, but we would only require the Class B, the cheaper unit. Something we're proposing here is this was something that could have an economic impact during the COVID downturn. During a normal year, this would not be a big deal. We are concerned just because of the weird economic conditions right now, and so we're proposing to delay implementation of this requirement until 2022. DFW training is another proposed compliance and reporting requirements. We recognize that many of these operators have years and decades on the water and are very experienced and knowledgeable. The training, it would serve a couple purposes. One, any new businesses coming on the scene, we want them to be up to speed and to have the best available knowledge so they can follow the rules. And two, we want to make sure all of the operators have a thorough understanding of the new rules and how they'll be enforced and adaptively managed. So this is just another way for us to connect regularly with the industry and not provide much of a burden while building their relationship, hopefully. And our final compliance and reporting requirement is that SRKW sightings are sent real time to the Whale Report Alert System. This is something that has been adopted. It was developed in BC, but it has been adopted by WSDOT and is now an initiative on the US side as well. Essentially what that is that trained mariners put whale sighting information into this system, and it's used to notify those large shipping vessels so that they can alter their course or slow down and avoid potential whale collisions or noise impacts. So this is a really exciting program, and this is going to be a really key piece of data feeding into this system. Penalties, there's already an existing $500 fine for violating vessel distance and speed rules. We've added a $500 penalty for infractions for violating the other whale watching rules as well. There's also already defined by the statute criminal misdemeanor charges possible for violating these SRKW focused rules. Okay, so I'm focusing in on the differences between A and B now. Both limit SRKW viewing to certain months, and both contain the months July through September, which is high whale watching season. Option A limits viewing SRKW to 2 2-hour periods from Friday to Monday, and with a limit of 3 vessels per group of SRKW. We've conceptualized, and initially in early October got public feedback on having those 3 months of viewing daily, still 2 2-hour periods, but every day of the month, not just the 4 days a week. And the idea we had based on public feedback was that we would spread out some of those days into a shoulder season. So we developed option B with a May to June and October to November shoulder season, as well as we were thinking more limited days during the July through September season. However, when we filed the rules, for some reason, I included the Friday through Monday restriction in option A as well, which did make it more restrictive. And that is what we accepted public comments on, but we also invited the public to comment on the idea of daily viewing. So you can see that those are matching there instead of different currently, but then option B does add these 4 additional months for a total of 7 months. This is a graph that just summarizes, or a chart that summarizes the what I just told you. One thing to note that I'll explain here, I think it's more helpful to look at the calendar. So these days highlighted in yellow are the days that would allow 3 vessels at a time to view any one group of SRKW during those 2 2-hour daily periods. The blue in option B adds that additional shoulder season on both sides with weekends, and it takes down the limit of the number of vessels to 1. So you'd have 1 vessel per group of SRKW. As I showed you in that image of groups of SRKW, they could be very spread out into, say, 10 groups. And then even during the days we only allow 1 vessel, you would have 10 vessels potentially viewing 1 with each group of whales at once. Okay, we are including in your packet a recommended adjustment of daily viewing July through September, because that just matches up with what we were, our initial concept of option A. However, I do want to point out that a lot of public comments like option A the way it was filed, so, and have submitted comments to that effect. The difference here, option A as filed is 52 days or 208 hours of viewing opportunity as an example in 2021. It adds 36 additional days in option B for 352 hours. If you looked at all 92 days available in this recommended adjustment, it's 368 hours total. So you can see option B and option A with that adjustment are pretty much equal in the total number of hours where viewing of SRKW would be permitted. I also want to point out while we're looking at the calendar that the whales come and go as they please. We cannot schedule them to show up on these days and times. We also can't guarantee that they will be there or not. And so if the whales are here none of those days, then there would be no viewing opportunity of SRKW just by happenstance. However, if the whales only showed up on those days, they would never experience days without viewing. So this is one of those things that is just a little unpredictable based on the whale's behavior and presence. So I'm coming back to this image that we looked at before to show you what it looks like to have a limit on a number of vessels in the vicinity. So here with the yellow group, you have 3 vessels in the vicinity of that group of whales. There's 3 vessels now with a group of whales that are in blue. These gray vessels that I just had come in are not in the vicinity, so that's not breaking the rules or outside of the limits. However, and here's a couple coming across from Canada, and I wanted to point out here that Canadian operators who are going to view whales at all on the U.S. side of the border would need to have the whale watching license, and they would follow the same rules as the U.S. operators regarding SRKW. If one of these vessels, this guy down in the blue, moved into the vicinity, now he's out of compliance because there's now 4 vessels in the vicinity of SRKW. So I just wanted to show you what that looks like. Focusing in just briefly on the analysis of feedback we've received so far. So first analysis, we did the small business economic impact statement. This was a requirement. It looked specifically at whether there would be disproportionate impacts of these rules on small businesses. It focused on the U.S. side of the industry and the DOR data available to the economics team. Here are a couple of the main conclusions from that report. So existing best practices are not expected to impact small businesses because it's existing and what they're doing. According to the PWWA, the Whale Watch Association guidelines, they're already following the no-go zone that's voluntary. The kayak positioning and raft up requirements in kelp are also already best practices that are hopefully being followed, so also not expected to have an impact. Unlikely to impact or have an effect, the number of boats, days and hours allowed viewing SRKW. And there's a quote here, and the top quote says, rule elements that limit viewing of SRKW only or that limit the geographic area where commercial whale watching activity may occur will not limit overall commercial whale watching activity because substitute viewing opportunities, both geographic and species-based, are available. So there's a lot out there. Transients, humpbacks have been back in larger numbers in recent years. So it's expected that any restrictions on viewing SRKW are not going to affect small businesses disproportionately economically. What may impact small businesses is the half-mile launch restriction for kayaks, because they may have to delay, find another launch location if the whales just happen to mill about in that half-mile circle around their launch point for a long period of time. That is possible, but the economic report concluded that given the relatively infrequent presence of SRKW in Washington's inland waters generally, poor launch delays are unlikely to occur frequently. Okay. Also in the SBEIS, the AIS was the only element that would result in more than minor costs, which is why we have proposed to delay implementation of that. During a normal year, this is not expected to be a burden on businesses. Initial public comment themes. We had several form letters that I've called out in the comments separately, so you can see the difference there or where those higher numbers are coming from. So we had some folks that submitted packages of multiple comments all at once that said very similar things. There was one petition that was sent to us, and then I received several emails with the same text from different people. So you can see that a lot of those supported the rules or supported restrictions on viewing SRKW. A handful, about 10, supported option B specifically, called that out. A larger amount support option A or option A as filed. And several of those actually promoted an option A with some additional restrictions. I'll show you what those restrictions were in just a moment. And then we still have quite a lot of people. I'm sure you'll hear all of these different perspectives today. We have a lot of people who are promoting a suspension on viewing SRKW. In the oppose the rules side, we had several folks who opposed options A and B. A lot of those commented on the positive values of commercial whale watching. A handful around 28 promoted a counter proposal to options A and B, and I'll show you that in just a moment. And also a handful of folks said we should redirect focus to other issues such as prey availability. And I wanted to remind you again, in your comment response, it goes through this in depth, but those main reasons of meeting the conservation value, having rules we can administer and enforce, and providing some industry opportunity are the reasons we proposed what we did. And so that kind of answers a lot of these points or responds why we did and didn't do certain things. Okay, I'm gonna leave this one up for just a minute here. And I know this is a lot of numbers, but I thought this would be a helpful graph for you for a couple of reasons. So right in the middle there, in the blue text, options A and B show you the restriction, number of months, days of the week we would allow viewing SRKW, the number of hours per day we'd allow the viewing of SRKW by motorized commercial whale watch vessels, number of motorized commercial whale watch vessels allowed in the vicinity. And then that we have some special circumstances. So our rules propose that we would have no boats allowed in the vicinity of a group that has a calf or a vulnerable whale, which we would issue an emergency rule to identify which whales those are. The west side of San Juan Island geographic restriction that would apply year round here in both of those versions, and the AIS and whale report alert system and log requirements we have as the compliance and reporting pieces. This compares to the far bookends of the status quo, where you can see a lot of these items are completely unrestricted and unlimited, although there's been a lot of voluntary reductions. For instance, in the number of boats around SRKW, a group of SRKW, and there are best practices that the industry has. On the suspend side, you can see also there are quite a lot of comments that are calling for all of these things to be taken down to zero. at least until such a time that the population shows adequate recovery, and then they believe maybe we could reevaluate and justify some viewing opportunity. Also on here in the gray, I've included two proposals that came from the advisory committee, Proposal L and Proposal J. The advisory committee didn't come to a consensus proposal, but they got as close as they could, and these are those two proposals. So you can see what those look like in comparison. And then the multiple public comments, I've got one on either side of options A and B. One, that first one to the left of option A is the modified version of option A that's being promoted in a lot of the comments. So their main suggestion is to reduce the number of boats during those days, hours, times to one, and to specifically call out pregnant whales as well as calves for the zero boat restriction. Those are some of the main points. I'm sure that the commenters will articulate them more clearly. On the other side, we have multiple public comments that are proposing essentially that we codify the existing best practices and voluntary reductions that have been made. So for instance, reducing the number of boats with a group of SRKW to five, and having a 45-minute time limit in the vicinity of SRKW. And that proposal as well includes mandating use of the whale warning flag, which is another current voluntary practice. Intergovernmental comments, I wanted to pull these out separately for you, and I think we've received more. So these comments I'm showing you are through last Saturday, the 28th. I will be rolling up the rest of the public comments received through tomorrow and giving you another updated report that includes the total numbers, and that'll include some additional intergovernmental comments as well. For now, the Fish Commission weighed in. They focused in on the no-go zone, compliance, monitoring, and enforcement as really key areas. San Juan County also focused in on compliance and monitoring and wanting a robust plan there. Both the Puget Sound Partnership and San Juan County supported option B. Puget Sound Partnership had some ideas of modifications to option B that they thought would make it stronger. And I think that included a reduction of the number of boats allowed to one, but decreasing restrictions outside of the core habitat in the San Juan Islands to a degree. I have a pack in your packet, a list of recommended adjustments. Some of those are just revisions, edits for clarity. A couple that I wanted to point out for you are that we added a definition for the inland waters of Washington, the same one that was in the bill. We defined the geographic scope of the viewing rules. Those go together. We removed that Friday through Monday restriction from option A, although, of course, you have the opportunity to reject that edit if you would go with option A. And we made some edits to the reporting requirements to make them clearer as well. Coming back to our timeline, the EIS, the Environmental Impact Statement through the CEPA process, the final version will be coming to you next week, as well as the full comment summary, as I was just saying. And your decision is scheduled hopefully for the 18th. And then after that, we would hopefully file the rules before the winter holidays. And we would probably also be filing emergency rules to cover the period between the filed date and the effective date, which would likely be in late January. The CEPA, I wanted to call out for you quickly. The final EIS is expected next week. It contains an analysis of the full spectrum of options, so from zero to status quo on all of these different variables. And that really preserves a lot of opportunity for you, the commissioners, to think through if you would like other options brought forward. And with that, I wanted to end with an acknowledgement. It's in small text because there's so many people that have been absolutely instrumental to moving this process along over the last year. So many staff, all the way up to the director himself, and then, of course, quite a lot of outside partners from the advisory committee members, intergovernmental partners, and so on, who weighed in and advised this process and who care very deeply about this issue. So with that, I will stop. Happy to answer questions, and otherwise I'll be hanging out and taking notes on all the public comment.
Any questions of Julie?
Larry, I have a question.
Commissioner Thorburn.
Julie, as I read the rules about the training requirement, it's to be repeated annually, and I was just curious why, what was the thinking behind an annual requirement for training?
Sure. The idea there is that we will have a bigger first-time training that kind of goes through everything in more depth. And then in follow-up years, that'll be more of a refresher. So a shorter period of time, it's a chance to check in on what's changed, if there's new science available, and to update any new staff that have come on board. So the idea there is that it keeps the conversation going. Particularly, we have a requirement every 2 years for the next several years to report back on the effectiveness of these rules and adaptively manage them. So it gives us that ongoing conversation to check back in at actively managing the system.
Commissioner Mikhajic and then Commissioner Anderson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions. First on the EIS. When we see the final EIS, which went out for public comment in September, you say it's got the full breadth of options. When you look at slide 47, does the EIS analyze all of those options that that are described on that? And you mentioned that if the commission has any feathering of any of these options, will the EIS analyze those too?
Yes. So the way that looks, and I'd be happy to send you the draft that went out for comments, if you'd like to see that even before the final comes out. The draft includes spectrums for each of these different variables. So say a spectrum of number of months where you allow the viewing opportunity, or a spectrum of the number of hours per day. And that essentially goes from zero to status quo on each one. So the analysis already contains a lot of any feathering that you might want to do. What we will do after this meeting is put a preferred alternative based on any indications we get from you. On Monday, likely, I will tell the SEPA team what a preferred alternative might be shaping up to look like, and they'll include that with its own specific analysis. However, the whole world of things is in there, and as you can imagine, a lot of that analysis looks like, you know, zero to X is going to have slightly more benefit than X to Y, for instance. So it's kind of general, but it preserves a lot of that opportunity to do feathering opportunities, as you were saying.
So, for example, on slide 47, there seems to be a twist there. If there's a calf in the group or not, you mentioned something with a pregnant killer whale in the group. Does the EIS analyze what the difference is in the definition of a group, whether there's a calf or not? Does it get into that kind of detail, or is it just a spectrum thing?
Thank you, Commissioner. That's a great question. I think to a degree they did use a unified definition of group. However, because the options there are listed as here's what zero looks like and then here's what three looks like, we have a whole section of the SEPA that discusses, or the EIS that discusses nesting, and that's what we would be doing there. So you're nesting a different number of boats under certain conditions than others, and the analysis does kind of explore what that nesting might look like and how it might result in different impacts. And an example of nesting that's currently in Proposal B is that you have a different number of boats allowed in certain months than allowed in the vicinity of a group of whales in other months.
And a question on the best available science. So this is all about commercial whale watching vessels, and does not contain any rules and regulations for private vessels, as I understand it. So what portion of the noise that the southern resident killer whales are dealing with, away from the world of noise of big ships and the shipping lanes, fishing events, all these other things, but just in the world of whale watching, where boats that are out there, private and commercial, looking and watching, what portion of all the noise is related to commercial whale watching boats versus private, individual small boats?
Thank you, Commissioner. That's a great question, and I don't have the data in front of me right now, so I can respond generally, and I'd be happy to follow up with you with more specifics. The overall takeaway point is that, one, commercial whale-watching vessels are different than a lot of the other vessel types in that they are seeking and viewing the whales specifically. But, two, the SoundWatch data — SoundWatch is an NGO organization that's out educating and talking to private boaters about the rules. They also do a lot of data collection, and more of the incidents around SRKW of violating the rules, either speed or distance, do happen from private boaters. So both of those are pieces of the broader puzzle. It's just that these rules, we were only given authority to address commercial whale watching, and the legislature thought it was important to reduce noise impacts from this industry specifically.
Well, the reason I'm asking this is I'm going to have a question about the Sentinel situation here. But I mean, is it 50-50, or is it 90% commercial and only 10% private? Or if you're just going to broadly characterize it, when I've been in the area, it seems like there's been more private vessels than commercial vessels. Of course, this was back when people were, you know, lots of boats running at the whales and all of that kind of thing. But, I mean, is it 50-50, or is it substantially now just commercial whale watchers?
Again, a great question, and I don't have exact information, but I'm happy to find more. But what I would point out is that it's going to be an it depends answer. There are some areas that have high recreational boater traffic, say the west side of San Juan Island, Salmon Bank. You've got a lot more private boats out there. And so in those cases, the numbers might be very different than somewhere out in the middle of the strait where whale watch boats might be the only ones present. So in one case where there's a lot of recreational traffic in the area, you might have very different proportions than in another area that's not really populated by recreational boaters as much.
Okay. It seems curious how best available science gets to that depends so often. So it gets to this question. If private vessels are a significant concern, there's a big question about the Sentinel role. And option A and option B both have some days closed to commercial vessels, but not closed to private vessels. So in the world of adaptive management, needing further study and some of these other things that were spoken to, is there any thinking about using either option A or option B as an opportunity to evaluate whether or not there's a Sentinel benefit, or whether it's all, as one of the written comments that we received, I won't go into what that was description was, but anyway, not as useful or something, I'll be polite.
Thank you so much. That is a great question, and exactly what we're hoping to do with our logging and reporting requirements. We know there needs to be a more thorough study that goes through, that can pass scientific muster about the Sentinel role or value and what that looks like. There's also folks who believe that there's a magnet role of when whale watch boats are present, maybe more private boats come to the scene. Those have been supported by evidence. The science panel specifically said, don't use a potential Sentinel role as a way to justify allowing more boats on with SRKW. And so using that precautionary approach is what we've gone with here, but we really do want to work with the industry and study this. We also want to see what the Sentinel role is through the use of the whale report alert system. So yes, we want to study it. Yes, the plan is that we would roll all of that up and then report back to the legislature in our adaptive management recommendations. And those reports back to the legislature will include information about any recommendations we have for how they might change how they manage recreational vessels near SRKW. So based on what we learned, we might be asking the legislature to think more carefully about what they might do on recreational vessels as well.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Anderson. Commissioner McKay, excuse me, Commissioner Anderson, and then Commissioner Linville have their hand up.
Okay, first off, thanks for a good presentation with a very complex and difficult subject. So I appreciate that. I learned a lot. I had one question very focused on slide 46. You mentioned the Puget Sound Partnership supported a modified option B, and you talked about the modifications, and I was, what were the modifications that they actually had proposed?
I will repeat what I remember, and then I'm happy to send you their full letter, and I'm hoping also that someone from the partnership is here today and can share their comments, because they'll always be a better advocate for what they were saying than I can be. But what I heard, what I remember from those comments is that they liked option B. They prefer that during July through September to reduce the number of vessels allowed per group of SRKW from 3 to 1. But they also proposed perhaps not having the same seasonal restrictions, still keeping the 2 2-hour periods per day, but not having those seasonal restrictions in place outside of the San Juan Islands. So perhaps, and I believe the justification given there was that would allow more reporting on the whales' activities during the winter when they're venturing down further into Puget Sound, while still keeping that one boat limit so that it's not increasing, greatly increasing the impact of the vessels. So. Okay. They were really focusing in on the trade-offs between what value from mandated reporting can we get from the industry with how do we still make sure that the industry impact is as low as possible.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Linville, please.
I haven't made it through all the material, so if this was in there and I missed it, I apologize. My question is sort of around, I always have a concern about turning something off with no path to turning it back on again. And so I'm really curious, is there a path to success or is there a vision for, okay, we've arrived, we're feeling good about this and we can sort of turn whale watching back on for these three pods?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Commissioner. I first want to stress that we're not turning it off completely. We're turning down the volume quite a bit, but still having, you know, somewhere between 50 and 100 days of whale watching on Southern residents allowed in a year. So it's not turning it off. It's not a moratorium. It's not a suspension. It's just a bigger reduction to reduce those impacts. So that's one piece. And the second piece to answer your question directly is, yes, there's a pathway, the clearest of which is this adaptive management timeframe of reporting back to the legislature in December 2022, 24, and 26. So as we're seeing the results of this program and how things are changing on the water and with the southern residents, we might be getting indicators that tell us maybe you don't need to have these restrictions in place. And maybe even which specific restrictions could be loosened up or tightened up on the other hand. The science panels specifically give us a report of adaptive management recommendations. One of the things that they called out is that this is a population, they live a long time, takes a long time to see population level impacts. So a lot of times we're going to be looking at proxies for that near-term adaptive management, such as, you know, their behavior in the water in the moment. So we'll be looking at that near-term adaptive management data, but also looking at those longer-term population impacts and wondering if we get to a point where the population has recovered substantially that maybe we don't need to have these types of restrictions at all. We can keep the licensing and keep that relationship going. The one other piece that I want to draw your attention to is that the adaptive management plan gives us that chance to measure the sentinel role. If it turns out that the sentinel impact, as the industry describes it, on recreational vessels outweighs the noise impacts of having vessels nearby, perhaps that might lead us to recommend changes to the rules would allow more viewing opportunity in exchange for that value. But that's something we really have to measure before we start proposing those types of changes.
Can I follow up, Chair, just really quickly?
Yes, please do. And then when you're done, Vice Chair Baker has her hand up.
So there isn't sort of a set number that we're shooting for. Is that correct? Like, you know, increase in reproductive rates of, you know, 2% per annually. Is it, there's no sort of number we're shooting for. Is that correct?
There are general recovery goals that NOAA has that they'd like to see us keep pace with at something like 2.4% increase annually to reach their recovery goal. So yeah, that is something we would be looking. If the whales were taken off of the endangered species list, we'd be having a very different conversation.
Thank you, Commissioner Linville. Vice Chair Baker, please. Unmute yourself, Barbara. Thank you.
I am so sorry. Like Commissioner Linville, I share the turning on and off concern. My larger concern, however, is taking very incremental steps to solve a very large problem. So my question here is, I kind of wonder how long a suspension or a moratorium stayed on the table once the legislature passed 5577, given the fact that both Canada has suspended commercial whale watching on this almost extinct bunch of animals. And then our two-year governor's task force suggested a temporary moratorium. I'm just trying to figure out really whether the cost of a short or a temporary moratorium, whether the trade-off of having some whale watching, but then all the bureaucracy and enforcement and rules that we would have to implement to manage that is worth it, or whether we should go with the suggestion of the task force and the way the Canadian government's handling it.
Thank you for that question. So we did include taking the variables the whole way to zero in the SEPA EIS analysis. And so we've preserved that opportunity for that conversation for you all. The rules we put forward, we're pretty confident will meet our conservation objective while also meeting our values around watchable wildlife and things like that. So it's there. It's there for you all to discuss. Certainly a lot of public commenters that you'll probably hear from today and that we've heard from so far are interested in a temporary moratorium or suspension. And certainly the vessels issue is one where we have the ability to make more immediate changes, whereas salmon recovery to support SRKW prey availability will take a little bit longer to see the results of that. So I certainly think that the commission has full ability to discuss that, and if you all would like us to draw what that recommendation looks like, we would do so for you.
Thank you.
Okay, if there's no other questions, we are, I guess, a couple of things. Nate, in respect to agenda item 8, it appears we're farther behind schedule than we had anticipated. So unless, if the commission is fine with moving that to our next meeting, Commissioner Anderson, I'm speaking to you as well. I think we're going to have to do that. I understand we have something near or in excess of 40, folks that want to make public comment on this, item. I also expect that the commissioners that I'm looking at probably want to get lunch at some point. So I'm going to propose we take the public comment. And then before we go to the sustainable seafood piece, we'll grab a bite to eat. Probably be a 30-minute lunch, not a one-hour lunch. So any objection to that, folks? Okay. Nikki, why don't you go ahead and read the preamble here, and then I have some comments to add before we start taking public comment.
Okay. We will now take public comment from attendees. As a reminder, everyone receives 3 minutes for comment. That might be modified depending on what Larry says. Everyone is currently muted. If you have a question, please raise your hand. If you're on the phone, sorry, if you're on the computer, the raise hand button appears under your name. If you're on the phone, please press *9 and wait to hear you have been unmuted. That's your indication it is your turn to speak. So let's see. So far we only have 6 folks, but I'm sure that's going to change in a minute.
Okay. Well, I have a couple of comments I'd like to add here respectfully. I just want to say that the commission, commissioners individually and as a group always appreciate public comments. It's an important part of how we learn and interact with people. But I'm going to respectfully request that the individuals are going to speak to a couple things. Limit yourself to 2 minutes, please. If there are elected officials on here, which I expect there are, you don't have to live by the 2-minute rule. If there's multiple similar comments and commenters, and you're going to say the same thing as a group of other people, please state that you agree with the previous commenter and give your name so we have your name for the record. We have a lot of work yet to do today. We want to hear from you in a meaningful way, but we would appreciate your consideration as well. So with that, Nikki, go ahead and introduce one or two as you see fit.
Okay, we're going to start with Mayor Will Hall, then roll into Stephanie Celine and Les Purse. So go ahead, Mayor. Make sure to unmute yourself.
Thank you very much. I'm Will Hall, Mayor of the City of Shoreline. I represent about 60,000 people living just north of Seattle, and we are adjacent to Puget Sound itself. I also served on the Governor's ORCA Task Force, and I serve on the Puget Sound Partnership's Ecosystem Coordination Board, which I had the honor of chairing for 4 years. As you know, people really want to protect our orcas, and I see and hear evidence of that every day right here in my city. We have a whale trail sign in a park where people safely watch the orcas from shore. We have a neighborhood group that used their own money to commission artists who created 22 beautiful orca structures that they placed around our city. And I hope you can see a picture of one behind me when it was on display in City Hall. I also have a stack of letters from school children asking us to work to save the whales. In my 11 years in office, in all my trips to the grocery store, in every constituent call and letter, I haven't heard people in my community ask me to allow more whale watching that could put these whales at risk. On the Governor's ORCA Task Force, we thoroughly debated the pros and cons of whale watching. And as you know, we had recommended a 3 to 5 year complete timeout or suspension. But we only had the power to make recommendations. You have the power to make the rules. I envy you for that. This is your moment when you can make a difference that our grandchildren can thank you for every time they see these beautiful whales. We know that any vessel operating near these whales affects their behavior and puts the population at some increased risk. But unlike recreational boats and shipping, and these other boats were discussed by the commissioners today, only commercial whale watch operators are trying to make money by intentionally staying close to these whales frequently and for long periods of time. And I think that does justify the special regulations here. If you're looking to balance economic interests, please rely on the data that shows that even the presence of vessels does have an adverse impact on the whales, but restrictions on viewing the southern residents does not impact the profitability of the whale watch industry. And while commercial whale watchers may attract other boaters, the data that was described today does not suggest that we have any evidence yet that they're effective sentinels to protect the whales. So the right decision is to make these rules as protective as possible. I urge you to start with option A as filed, limiting the season, the times of day, and the days for viewing. And consistent with the studies you have, please improve protection for the whales without economically harming the industry by allowing only one vessel to visit them at a time. We all want these rules to be sufficient to support the recovery of the species, not merely slow down their extinction. Thank you very much for your time and for doing this important and very hard work.
Thank you very much for your comments, Mayor. Next, Nikki.
Okay, next we've got Stephanie Solmein. Go ahead, Stephanie.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for allowing public comment today. I am here as having served 2 years as co-chair, along with Les Peirce, of Governor Inslee's Southern Resident Orca Task Force. And Les and I are here today to speak to the importance of the draft commercial whale watching licensing options that are currently before you. We have not participated in the department's rulemaking to date. However, we think it's important to convey the serious context in which the task force recommended bold actions to reduce the effects of whale watching on southern residents. During the first year of the Orca Task Force, we learned a lot about vessel impacts. Underwater noise and vessel disturbance significantly impact southern residents' ability to forage. It affects their behavior in the water and their ability to communicate. They also appear to lose about 2 hours of potential feeding time per day due to the effects of masking noise from small vessels, such as commercial whale watching and recreational boats. At our final meeting, the task force recognized the need for bold, protective, and immediate action. And as Mayor Hall said, the task force nearly unanimously recommended suspension of whale watching on southern residents for 3 to 5 years. We knew that the state's significant actions to increase the number of Chinook salmon would take time to materialize because the young salmon would need years at sea before they could come back as potential prey for the orcas. The task force recognized the urgent need to ensure that our young orcas and their mothers and extended family that provide for them would stay alive and thrive. We are fortunate now, as you may know, to have 2 new calves and pregnant mothers in the population. And that's why it's critical that the commission set especially strong rules in the short term. The legislature did not support the task force's recommendation to suspend commercial whale watching, but they did support a recommendation to establish a limited entry whale watching permit system for commercial whale watching. And it's those draft regulations that you have before you today. We have clear scientific validation from the Washington State Academy of Sciences that we must apply the precautionary principle and minimize or even temporarily eliminate commercial whale watching on southern residents. The Academy has affirmed that there is no convincing evidence of the sentinel benefit of commercial whale watching, and I'm glad that the department is looking to study that further. Indeed, the presence of commercial vessels may in fact draw more boaters and commercial operators in. So finally, either of the options before you would help set a minimum standard to help fulfill the task force's recommendations. However, our hope as co-chairs is that you will choose the most protective regulations possible to help quiet the waters for these fragile southern resident orcas. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your comments today, Stephanie. Next, Nikki.
Next, we've got Les Peirce, followed by Rob Crabill. Go ahead, Les. Make sure you're unmuted.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you.
I want to start out, and I'll be brief because I know time is short, but I have to thank WDFW and the work group for the extraordinary work that they have put in to bring these regulations and recommendations before the commission. Dr. Watson, in your presentation, as I listened to your presentation explaining the issues as it related to the economics, to the science, it spelled it out beautifully in regard to what those findings are as directed by the legislature to perform this work. And in thinking about the long journey that the task force began over 2 years ago. And now, having this recommendation come before you commissioners, I simply want to say that, I couldn't be more proud of the work, and to think that the citizens and the work of our democracy here in the state of Washington is working as well as it is. I simply urge our commissioners, who are obviously committed and interested in doing the best for our natural resources, to look at these recommendations and recognize, as I'm sure you do, that we have an opportunity here to take some steps that will have the best result in protecting these orcas. The opportunity is there for all of us as citizens to follow this course. And I urge you, after you've seen the science and weighed the science and listened to the best minds that we have in all these categories, to take those steps to be protective of them in the most aggressive way that you feel comfortable doing within the regulations that you have. I also want to say thank you to the whale-watching community. They've been at the table with us, and they've been with the table with the working group. And while they have expressed their position, and while they have been known as being conservationists, we applaud that. But we're simply in a period of time now that all of us must lend our hearts and our effort to the best way to ensure that these orca have a chance of survival. And so I call on them and all of you to follow through with this long-term work that all of us have been involved with in this journey, and to help us begin this good work of protecting these wonderful animals. And commissioners, thank you for listening to us, and thank you so much for the work you're doing.
Les, thank you very much for your comments. Nikki, next, please.
Next, we've got Rob Crabo, followed by Brian Goodremont. Go ahead, Rob.
All right, can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Excellent. Well, good afternoon, Chair Carpenter, members of the commission. I want to thank you all for the opportunity to provide public comment. And I also want to say a special thanks to Dr. Julie Watson for all the hard work that she's done on developing these rules and engaging stakeholders. I'm a Northwest representative with Defenders of Wildlife based out of Tacoma, Washington. I'm also a member of the Wildlife Diversity Advisory Council and was recently appointed to the Budget and Policy Advisory Group for the commission. Defenders of Wildlife supports the rulemaking process and placing regulations on the whale watching industry, and we view these as one part of the overall effort to reduce underwater noise that disturbs orcas. In the long run, saving the orcas will require us to reduce pollution and recover salmon through habitat restoration projects like the proposed restoration at Skagit Wildlife Area and removal of harmful dams like the Electron Dam on the Puyallup River. These actions, though, as others have said, take time. So in the near term, noise reduction can have the most immediate beneficial impact for our southern resident orcas. Of the options, we support option A as it was originally filed with the restrictions on daily viewing and view it as the most protective. Option B, which is the shoulder season, we view as inappropriate to consider right now and should only be considered after we learn more about the effectiveness of the rules adopted. While option A is more protective, we see opportunities for it to be strengthened and to become more protected. We submitted a full comment letter with suggestions, but some of the top ones include reducing the number of vessels that can be with a group of southern residents from 3 to 1, to increase the adaptive management potential of the rules by allowing the department to suspend viewing of southern residents when females are pregnant, when individuals show signs of peanut head, or if the population growth rate from the previous year was below the 2.3% stated recovery goal growth rate. Also, we'd like to see increased penalties for violations. The current $500 fine is far too low. The department should also increase penalties for repeat offenders so that licenses can be revoked. And the department should also have the authority to close all viewing across the fleet if multiple operators are violating the rules. As I said, we submitted a more detailed comment letters with specific recommendations for strengthening option A. Regardless of the final rule adopted, though, these rules will not be effective if WDFW does not also increase its on-water enforcement. While most of the commercial whale watching is happening around the San Juans, the orcas are also seen in the South Sound, and the department has a duty to enforce regulations for both commercial and private whale watchers. Last weekend, I viewed J-POD from the shores of Point Defiance in Tacoma and witnessed several boats on the water who appeared to violate both distance and speed regulations set for these private boaters. WDFW enforcement was not present. Increasing on-water enforcement and patrols should be a priority for the department in addition to adopting these rules when thinking about recovering southern resident orcas. Thank you very much. We encourage you to adopt and strengthen option A and look forward to the rest of this process.
Thank you for your comments, Rob. Nikki, next, please.
Next, we've got, Brian Goodremont. Go ahead, Brian.
Thank you, commissioners, for the opportunity to speak today. I wanted to address briefly a concerning narrative that has been communicated through this process and in public that a moratorium was the will of the task force. That's not a fully accurate statement. And this narrative has contributed to the negative public perception and anti-whale watching sentiment, and it has further polarized this issue. Orca Task Force Recommendation 28 was to create a whale sanctuary, no boat zone on the west side of San Juan Island. This recommendation came from a year of science panel meetings and public engagement. Yet when consensus was not reached, maneuvering resulted in the Recommendation 28 changing to a moratorium. This was against task force protocol and undermined the science panel recommendations and the public who participated in this process for over a year. The science panel declined to advance this recommendation of a moratorium during the science panel because of a lack of efficacy. I'd like to share with you one of my personal experiences. On November 22nd, just 2 weeks ago, I was with J-POD exiting Admiralty Inlet, heading northwest towards the Strait of Juan de Fuca. This put the whales in a direct path with a Navy destroyer traveling 35 knots from Eastern Bank towards Admiralty Inlet. I was the only vessel with J-POD and slowed the destroyer by contacting them on the VHF. Under these proposed draft rules, you will be removing this protective role that I played and the hundreds of sentinel actions documented in our pilot study in 2019. In 2020. It's hard for me to hear that the sentinel actions were not recognized by the National Academy of Science. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your comments, Brian. Next, Nikki.
Okay, next we've got Sophia Ressler followed by Brendan Flynn. Go ahead, Sophia.
Thank you, and good afternoon, I guess, Chairman Carpenter and members of the Commission. Again, Sophia Ressler, Center for Biological Diversity. I don't know how many of you have seen an orca from either land or a boat. I've been lucky enough to have had the experience many times. Orca dorsal fins are incredibly challenging to spot from a distance. It's much easier, however, to find a commercial whale-watching vessel from a distance, which is why I have watched countless times as recreational boats gravitate towards commercial whale watching vessels in hopes of seeing orcas. That's not a sentinel role. In fact, it's the opposite. I think it's vitally important to remember that these operations are commercial ventures. Commercial whale watching vessels do not go out with the expressed intention of protecting the whales. They have paying customers that want to see the whales, and they provide a service to them. If commercial whale watching vessels really wanted to protect the whales, why aren't they all willing to share their data with WDFW enforcement? Why not voluntarily stop watching the SRKWs like their colleagues in BC and in turn not give clues to recreational boaters about where the southern residents are located? If there really is a sentinel role, let's give WDFW enforcement the resources they need to fill that role. We should not be relying on an industry that profits off the southern residents to also play the role of protecting them, especially when those two roles are often conflicting. I'm under no delusion that restricting commercial whale watching alone will save the whales, which is why the center is doing work on SRKW protection from every angle.
However, this is an opportunity for the commission to show strong leadership and send a message to recreational boaters, federal agencies, and the world that we are serious about protecting the southern residents from vessel noise and disturbance in order to give them a fighting chance. Option A as presented is a serious compromise. If the commission were to follow the science and the economic analysis, there would be no watching of the SRKWs, which would not be a moratorium. It would apply to only a specific set of whales that make up just 10% of whale watching opportunity with no significant economic consequences. However, option A is the absolute least that can be done to protect these whales. We strongly encourage that the commission strengthen option A, but at a minimum, select option A as written. Please don't let this beautiful, iconic, intelligent species go extinct to appease commercial interests. Thank you for your time.
Sophia, thank you very much for your comments. Next, Nikki.
Next, we've got Brendan. Go ahead, Brendan.
Hey, can you hear me there?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Hey, I just want to thank everybody who's been working on this all this time since the task force wrapped up. I realize how much you've all put into it and really appreciate it. I served on the task force as a commercial fisheries representative, and I just want to say I really agree with some of the statements that a number of the folks have made up until this point. I don't mean to flog a dead horse. I know, Commissioner Carpenter, you didn't want to hear things multiple times, and I just want to say my experience as a commercial fisherman in the islands here, I've lived in San Juan Islands my whole life, and time again, what we see out here is boats beget boats and tend to be an aggregator. I would really like to voice my support for option A, amended to reduce the number of boats to one vessel. I understand the industry's assertion that they are sentinels for these whales, and that has not been studied thoroughly to this point and is not fully understood. So if they were able to still have one vessel available to do that, put up their whale flag and notify people, that could be looked into. But I find it troubling that the industry has pushed back so hard on this. When you look at the number of times we have taken cut after cut after cut to our commercial fisheries to try to provide more fish to the spawning grounds and more fish to these whales, yet the whale watching industry has, in my opinion, not made adequate sacrifices in turn. One other thing in regard to option A is, I favor A over B because in those shoulder seasons that are proposed for watching in, both the spring and the fall, in the spring, you have the whales chasing, what we know now is a scant number of spring Chinook, and, any added stressors to them during that season when they're already compromised is going to be problematic. And again, in the fall, they're, down sound chasing chums and going into, a long dark winter, preparing to, calve at the end of winter, and they need all the fat stores they can get, and to not be, distracted from their feeding. Okay. I'll finish up now. Thanks.
Thank you for your comments, Brendan. Next, Nikki.
Next, we've got Kevin Campion, followed by Michael Jasny. Go ahead, Kevin. Make sure you're unmuted.
Hey, I am unmuted, and are you able to hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, dang, can't believe I get to speak before Michael Jasny. First off, I'll just say thanks to everyone who's charged with making a decision on this. It's a big responsibility, and I appreciate you taking the time and interest and weighing all this. And in the interest of time, I'll say that I strongly agree with Rob from Defenders of Wildlife, from Sophia from Center for Biological Diversity, from the Mayor of Shoreline. That was awesome. Thank you. So I, for the last 10 years, have run an education program on the Salish Sea, teaching whale conservation and whale ecology. And with that, have relied very heavily on seeing the whales from a boat and showing those to those whales to teenagers. And with that, I am very happy to say, or very, would urge you all to say, that reducing the impacts of vessels, including my own, on the whales and on the southern resident killer whales, seems like what is required in taking the precautionary principle. And with that, it seems like option A and a modified option A that allows one vessel would be the most precautionary approach outside of a moratorium, which seems like it's not really on the table here. And I would, so fully supporting option A if a moratorium is not possible. And I would also, along with the other commenters, like to just question that sentinel role that the whale watch boats claim to hold, and say that I have not really seen evidence of that, some anecdotal evidence to the contrary, and would just, yeah, really like to see more science on that before we make a decision that includes that. And lastly, we'll say that strongly urge enforcement and more enforcement. And none of these things are going to work without a stronger enforcement. I know that it is very minimal. It has been with the current regulations, and I'm not hearing a plan to make that, to up the enforcement activity. And so all of this seems moot if we can't get more enforcement on there. So thanks for your time, and I'll mute myself now. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments today, Kevin. Nikki, next, please.
Next, we've got Michael Jasny, followed by Donna Sandstrom. Go ahead, Michael.
Great. Am I unmuted? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Michael Jasny. I direct the Marine Mammal Protection Project at NRDC, and I've worked on issues concerning underwater noise for more than 20 years. I was a member of the stakeholder working group on commercial whale watching organized by DFW. But as a Canadian, I've also been very involved in this issue on the other side of the border. And I thought the way I could be most helpful here is by flagging two points about Canada. The first concerns the sentinel effect. On March 10th, a U.S. whale watching boat operating on the Canadian side in Active Pass spotted a group of southern residents, and in an effort to warn BC ferries away from the whales, gave some bad advice. Their advice would have brought a ferry directly on top of the whales, and that would have occurred but for the intervention of a government researcher who happened also to be in the water that day. Now, this is an anecdote, but it illustrates the danger of relying on commercial vessels to perform what is properly an enforcement function. It was for good reason that your own Washington Academy of Sciences panel, in its July 31st report to DFW, concluded that claims of a sentinel effect could not be used to justify a precautionary policy for the whales. My second point is about alignment with Canadian policy on commercial whale watching on the southern residents. Since 2018, I've been engaged in all aspects of this issue in Canada. I've participated in related litigation and have served on several of the federal government's technical working groups on orcas. I understand the science, the positions taken by the relevant agencies, and the opinion of the public in BC. And from that experience, I can tell you with confidence that you will not achieve transboundary alignment through a regulation that allows three commercial boats around the whales. There is no way that will happen. There's simply too much daylight with the Canadian policy, which presently allows zero intentional commercial viewing of the southern residents. And not achieving alignment would be a true setback, given the benefits to implementation and enforcement from a uniform licensing program. NRDC supports a suspension. We would also support option A as originally filed, but modified to allow only a single commercial vessel around the whales. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael, for your comments. Nikki, next, please.
Next, we've got Donna Sandstrom, followed by Aaron Gleiss. Go ahead, Donna.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for the opportunity to comment today. I'm the founder and director of the Whale Trail, a series of locations to view orcas and other marine mammals from shore. The department has been a core team partner in the Whale Trail since our founding, and I'm grateful for your support. As a member of Governor Inslee's task force, I envisioned and championed the licensing system as a way to reduce noise and disturbance around the critically endangered orcas. The rulemaking language was calibrated with department staff to ensure it was consistent with how the department manages other species. If properly applied, these rules will create the possibility of watching southern resident orcas in the future. If not, that future is foreclosed. We support a full suspension of whale watching for the next few critical years. But if that is not possible, we do support option A because it gives the orcas more of their time undisturbed. In my comments today, I want to address a few of the things we've heard over the last few weeks. First, is this a moratorium that was rejected by the legislature? No. That is a long closed chapter, unfortunately. The department has followed the best available science independently to create rules that protect the population the same as it does for any other species. In its rulemaking process, they were guided by neutral, independent entities, including the Washington Academy of Science, an advisory council on which commercial operators and their allies held a majority seat. The data did not land where the industry wanted, and so now they are sowing doubt and confusion about the process and your mandate. Do not be distracted. An important finding of this process was that there is no economic need for operators to watch southern resident orcas. While the orcas have come back less and less, they have built a thriving business watching other species. Their revenue tripled over the past decade. Having lost the economic argument to approach the orcas, the industry now says they need to get close to the orcas because they serve a sentinel function. That flies in the face of common sense and their track record. 10 years of Soundwatch data shows that commercial vessels, like all boaters, are 2 to 3 times more likely to disobey guidelines and laws unless Fish and Wildlife Enforcement is present. Fish and Wildlife Marine Patrols are the actual sentinels. If you want to protect the southern residents from recreational and all boaters, make sure DFW Marine Patrols are fully funded. Second, through a comprehensive sighting network and a proprietary app.
Right, time, Donna.
Okay. Thank you very much. And this is good luck in your deliberations. Thank you.
Donna, thank you for your comments today. Next, Nikki.
Next, we've got Aaron Gleiss, followed by Kelly Balcombe-Bartok. Go ahead, Aaron, and please correct me if I said your last name wrong.
No worries. My name is Erin Gless. I am a local marine biologist and whale watching naturalist. When it was first announced that WDFW was creating a commercial whale watching license, I was relieved. In my time on the water, I have seen many close calls, and I was excited at the prospect that only licensed professionals would be allowed in the vicinity of southern residents, as that's how licenses traditionally work. When these licensing options were released, however, I was shocked to find that instead WDFW proposed a system that removes trained professionals for most of the year, while the general public could view southern residents at any month, day, or hour they'd like without having to pay for or adhere to the strict and at times hurtful requirements of the license. The statute requires a license that will reduce the daily and cumulative impacts on southern residents, but the removal of professionals will increase those cumulative impacts. Commercial boats are not magnets. The vessel monitoring group Soundwatch observes that when vessels see us, they slow down and steer away. Their reports also show that both the overall number of vessels and the number of infractions around whales decrease if whale watch boats are present. A 2015 NOAA study found that vessels traveling slowly are quietest. A recent Port of Vancouver report showed that whale watch vessels contribute just 0.6% of underwater sound in the region, yet our actions help slow all other vessels that generate the remaining 99% of that sound. I recommend the commission watch Wednesday's Senate Natural Resources Committee meeting where I presented on this further. In 2020, nearly 90% of professional southern resident sightings occurred when there was no law enforcement present, with WDFW on the water just 20 days that southern residents were reported. Commercial operators are often the whale's only line of defense. I strongly urge the committee to reconsider this approach and align more with the original intent of the statute. By permitting responsible whale watch vessels year round, it ensures protection for the whales and valuable monitoring. Thank you.
Thank you, Erin, for your comments today. Nikki, next, please.
Next is Kelly Balcom Bartok, followed by Rain Adaman. Go ahead, Kelly.
All right. Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner members, for deliberating over this very obviously important topic that we all feel very strongly about. My name is Kelly Balcom Bartok, and I'm here before you today to ask that you do the right thing for the Whale Watch community, and especially the right thing for the whales. You have before you the PWWA's official statements, proposals, graphs, charts, facts, and figures. You have statements from scientists, educators, captains, naturalists, nonprofits, elected officials, and more who stand in solidarity with the Whale Watch community and support the important role that we play in conservation. I would especially direct you to submissions from Dr. David Bain of Orca Conservancy, Dr. Andrew Trites of UBC, and the consortium of orca groups with direct experience with killer whales. We are all people who've spent years, decades, a few of us our lifetimes, working closely with southern resident killer whales. We all share a deep passion for these whales, and we all want to do what's right. I'm concerned, however, that now is not the time that we turn our backs on the whales. That is, in essence, what both of these proposals could, in fact, do. And the arguments that we're having over Sentinel or Magnet are detracting from the reality that the Sentinel effect is real. The very nature of stopping a single vessel is stopping a vessel. The very nature of over 300 Sentinel actions this year alone provided by the Pacific Whale Watch Association, were nearly 200 of those were successful in stopping impacts on whales. So this is the time we learn to trust each other, to seek and join forces to collectively, collaboratively implement solutions that capitalize on our diverse sets of skills and resources for the betterment of the whales. There is a new path forward, and the Whale Watch community has already set upon it. It is one of collaboration, cooperation, and communication. And I would reiterate, having grown up with the whales in the San Juan Islands since the 1970s, been involved in Soundwatch and the establishment of Soundwatch and many of these studies, it frightens me terribly that we would not consider the Sentinel actions deeply and the reality, and that the arguments for and against are not being really considered. Look into the data that's been provided. Look into the materials. Please, I ask you, take the time to really review that. And listen to the experts. Listen to the ones that are in the field, the ones that see it happen on a daily basis, myself included, and the other orca experts that are out there. It is my sincere and heartfelt hope you will join us on this path to work with us and the Whale Watch community in developing a functional framework that embraces the skills, expertise, passion, perseverance, and professionalism of our Whale Watch community in real-world efforts to help save these whales. And as an adjunct, I would add, there's a couple of bits. 87% of vessels, Soundwatch data, by the way, for one of the commissioners in question, 87% of Soundwatch's interactions are with private vessels. So that was if you wanted to ask you asked earlier about Julie. And I just can't stress enough that the experts.
You're at time, Kelly.
Okay. Anyway, thank you. You've seen our materials. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks for your comments today, Kelly. Okay, next, Nikki.
Next is Rain Adaman, followed by Matt Stollmeyer. Go ahead, Rain.
Yes, hi. My name is Rain Adaman. I'm with Washington Environmental Council, representing 20,000 supporters throughout the state. Thank you, Chair Carpenter and members of the commission. Washington Environmental Council had the honor of being on Governor Inslee's Orca Recovery Task Force and on the advisory committee for this rulemaking process. I'd like to start off by commending the commission and DFW for adopting a 25-year strategic plan that redirects their commitments to, quote, protectively address conservation challenges, unquote, for fish, wildlife, and people. This management and paradigm shift comes at a critical time for the highly endangered southern resident population that is on the brink of extinction. The need for action on all the threats facing the species is great and immediate. Some actions will take longer to actualize than others, especially with prey availability, which is ongoing from removing dams, increasing hatchery production, restoring habitat, and reducing catch. Thank you, fishermen. Fortunately, this rule, specific to southern residents, can have an immediate benefit on the water starting as early as January 1st, 2021. We fully support the comments made by Defenders of Wildlife, Center for Biological Diversity, NRDC, Mayor Hall, the task force co-chairs, and Whale Trail. While we acknowledge there is a big problem with recreational boaters, the way to address this is through education enforcement, not through the central role in this process. Washington Academy of Science concluded that there is insufficient evidence to date to support a conclusion that the presence of commercial operators reduces other potential vessel impacts. In other words, the sentinel effect is not scientifically supported. Option A and option B do not meet the precautionary principle approach. And according to the best available science, significant exposure would still exist under both options with vessel noise and disturbance, vessel strike, potential strikes. A science panel report states that, quote, given that even a low number of vessels can cause behavioral responses, 3 to 5 vessels will still potentially disturb residents, unquote. And because there will be research, enforcement, and recreational boats in the vicinity at the time, the number of commercial operators needs to be much fewer than the threshold of 3 operators or 3 boats.
You're at time, Ryan.
Thank you. In conclusion, please take the precautionary approach, like other management efforts that the department has done with stock management. Thank you.
Rain, thanks for your comments today. Next, Nikki.
Next is Matt Stolemeyer, followed by David Bain. Go ahead, Matt.
Hi, thank you for taking public comment today. Really do appreciate that. My name is Matt Stolemeyer. I am entering my 14th year as a licensed professional captain in the whale watch industry. Grew up in the San Juan Islands. I wanted to share with you a experience that I had earlier this summer. It was on Thursday, July 2nd. It would have been on one of the days that were that are not part of the included or allowed whale watching days. JPOD was heading south through Boundary Pass, very spread out over about 7 nautical miles, linearly. Over 13 nautical miles square, basically from Skipjack Island to Stewart Island Turnpoint, heading southbound. As I approach from the east, knowing the route that the southern residents usually follow from my experience over the years, I sat idle about a half mile from Turnpoint, just kind of waiting for them to pass by, as the Canadian border was closed at the time, so I didn't want to be on the opposite side and get pinched between the border. There was only 2 whale watching vessels in the vicinity, about actually 1 nautical mile, so more than the vicinity as described by the rules. And there were 2 enforcement boats. There was a WDFW boat and a sheriff boat. There was also straight watch and sound watch, Center for Whale Research, and I believe Wild Orca was out there as well. There was also a Transport Canada plane flying overhead monitoring the Canadian border. Anyway, it was right there during the beginning of the salmon opener. Prawning was also open. There were several fishing boats in the area, and they saw some very active whales in the distance. Couldn't have been the draw of whale-watching vessels, as there wasn't many. I was nearer to shore. But I stopped 4 boats personally from zooming over towards the larger group, knowing that there was a much more calm group a little bit closer, within about 400 yards of where I was located. While I was doing that, using flags, using my horn, using the VHF radio, WDFW and the sheriff boat were miles away from us, a little further north, with another major line of whales dealing with boats up there. So you can see it's very difficult for these enforcement boats to enforce the rules over such a span of water. So it is really important that there are sentinels out there, sentinels that care about the whales, that want to educate people about the whales. And I'll tell you from that experience, I think I had more people on my boat come away with a positive from the whale watching community on our benefit to the whales, southern residents in particular, and our ability to slow vessels down and educate them while we wait for enforcement boats or other vessels to show up to do the jobs that they're also tasked with.
You're on time, Matt.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you allowing me to comment, and good luck with your decision.
Thank you for your comments today, Matt. Nikki, next.
Next is David Bain, followed by Gene Helfman. Go ahead, David.
Hi, I'm David Bain, Chief Scientist for Orca Conservancy. I've been studying the effects of whale watching on resident killer whales since 1982 and was the expert witness for the Crown and the first conviction of a whale watcher in Canada. While I'm well aware of the negative effects of close approaches by vessels to whales, I firmly believe the proposed regulations are misguided. Under ESA, direct takes of southern residents are prohibited. To prevent harm, the legislature enacted distance and speed regulations based on best available science. The impact on whales should not matter when, where, or how many compliant vessels are present. This rulemaking process is an opportunity to build on the legislation that prevents commercial whale watching from causing harm and require it to provide net ecological benefits. Sharing knowledge of whale locations and appropriate behavior with nearby vessels to prevent unintentional violation by recreational boaters, as Soundwatch does with some boaters, would provide a net benefit. Facilitating passenger contributions to salmon recovery would provide a net benefit in prey availability. The habitat restoration work by Whale Scout illustrates the value of this approach. Promoting whale-friendly lifestyles among passengers is a way to provide a net benefit in toxin reduction. Annual reports should provide data on the magnitude of these benefits. Whale watching should be managed with the best interests of southern residents in mind, not to support the pretense that the effect of a vessel on whales is different depending on whether the skipper is being paid. Adaptive management could optimize number of commercial whale watching vessels present. Too few would lead to extreme disturbance by other vessels and interfere with motivating passengers to participate in recovery. Too many would lead to navigational safety concerns, resulting in close approaches and precluding a meaningful experience that would motivate passengers to participate in recovery. Setting the number of whale watching vessels to zero ensures the number will be too low. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments today, David. Let's put in the last call if there's any people that want to comment. Nikki, we'll try and fit a few more in. Who's next, Nikki?
Next, it's Gene Healthman, followed by Todd Haas. Go ahead, Gene.
thank you, Ms. Klopfer, Commission members, and Dr. Watson. My name is Gene Healthman. I'm a retired conservation biologist living on Lopez Island with relevant experience on endangered species issues, and I'd like to comment on three issues. First, assuming a moratorium is not under consideration, I strongly concur with revisions submitted by the Friends of the San Juans favoring option A for the proposed rules, with the exception that the rules apply to both resident and transient ecotypes because the two can be confused. Second, I strongly urge the Commission to continue efforts to standardize regulations across Canada and the U.S. regarding both commercial and recreational whale watching, as per Michael Jasny's comments. Third, and most upsetting, is something that could potentially make this entire effort pointless. We recently learned that NOAA has approved a request from the Navy to allow their permissible annual take of resident orcas to increase from 2 to 51. I realize take has various meanings, but does include actual killing. A report in the News Tribune stated that the Navy determined that the population of southern residents was, quote, far denser than previous models showed, end quote. I can't think of an animal population better known and more accurately counted than the southern residents. Where is the Navy finding alternative data? And most importantly, how is it that the governor's task force recommendations, based on months of effort by dozens of experts, are basically disregarded and undermined by a federal agency? Implementation of this additional take basically negates any positive outcomes that might result from adoption of the proposed whale watch guidelines. I hope there is some means of reversing this decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Gene, for your comments today. Next, Nikki.
Next, we got Todd Haas, followed by Monica Shields.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Todd. I asked him to unmute. Okay, well, I'm going to move to Monica and then come back to Todd. Oh, wait, Todd figured it out. Todd, are you there? He looks unmuted. Okay, we're going to go to Monica and then try to come back to Todd. Go ahead, Monica.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
Yep, we can hear you.
My name is Monica Whelan Shields, and I'm the director of the nonprofit research group, the Orca Behavior Institute on San Juan Island. I first met the Southern residents aboard a whale watching trip at the age of 15, and it changed the course of my life. As a result, I've spent the last 20 years observing, studying, and advocating for them. I've read the science, and I can tell you, yes, vessels impact whales, but that there are so many factors that contribute to orcas' complex behavior in a complex environment that we cannot draw any simple conclusions about specific regulations that will help these whales recover. What we can say is that, in general, fewer, slower-moving boats at greater distances are better for mitigating impacts, but that applies to all vessels and not just commercial whale watching. Options A and B apply convoluted rules about days and times to only the boats with the most experienced operators. As a scientist, I do not see how limiting whale watching in this way will have any measurable benefit to the whales. In fact, I have no doubt that the unintended consequences of the rules as written will make Washington's waters less safe for the southern residents. Much of the science these regulations are based on was conducted before any orca vessel regulations were formalized in Washington state. We're continuing to make rules based on how things used to be without any updated data on how much things have improved. This, combined with the inherent complexity and uncertainty in vessel effects to begin with, makes it difficult, if not impossible, to write intricate rules that are actually based on relevant science. In light of this, and in the interest of supplementing the distance and speed regulations passed in the 2019 legislative session, I support the idea of a year-round limit of 3 commercial whale-watching vessels with the residents. This is easy to understand and enforce, takes a precautionary approach, and will have a clear benefit of reducing the overall number of vessels around the whales. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today.
Thank you for your comments as well, Monica. Next, Nikki.
Okay, we're going to try Todd again. Okay, Todd, it looks like you're unmuted. Are you unmuted on your end? Okay, we're just going to move on. Nora Nickum, followed by Amanda Colbert. Go ahead, Nora.
Thank you very much, Chair and Commissioners. My name is Nora Nickum, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Seattle Aquarium. By adopting strong rules that reduce vessel noise and disturbance, the Commission can directly support orca recovery with immediate changes on the water. Prey availability, as many have noted, is a critical issue, but an increased level of noise and disturbance by itself is still predicted to push the southern resident population further into decline. According to Soundwatch, commercial whale watching vessels make up more than half of the boats seen with the orcas. So while we must do more to address recreational boats, what you have before you now is in fact a meaningful opportunity to reduce overall noise and disturbance. The Seattle Aquarium supports educational whale watching experiences and cares about the industry's economic viability. But as you have heard, the report was clear that none of the proposed rules would harm operators' bottom lines, and the education can come when viewing transient orcas and other whale species. During this time of crisis, we are asking for on-water whale watching to focus on animals that are not critically endangered or as highly sensitive to disturbance. We prefer option A with Friday to Monday viewing, but note that the options before you are already a big compromise from the precautionary approach recommended by the science panel. That panel said that reducing disturbance would involve reducing not just speed, but also the distance and number of boats, because even quiet boats disturb orca foraging. We therefore urge a maximum of 1 commercial operator with each group of southern residents, although that will still frequently add up to multiple operators with each pod. DFW enforcement officers are charged with the true sentinel responsibilities, and it does not make sense, nor is it supported by science, to delegate that to commercial operators. The rules before you can help give the orcas a fighting chance as their situation otherwise continues to worsen, and we urge the Commission to take bold action. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you very much, Nora, for your comments today. Next, Nikki, please.
Next is Amanda Colbert, followed by Whitney Neubauer. Go ahead, Amanda.
Hi, thanks. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. Thank you for allowing me to comment today. My name is Amanda Colbert. I work on the education team with the nonprofit Orca Network and also as a volunteer educator with the nonprofit, the Salish Sea School. First, for the sake of time, I wanted the record to show that I do agree with Monica Whelan Shields, David Bain, and a few of the other comments and their points as they've been spoken previously. Secondly, I do not believe that option A nor option B as proposed truly benefit the southern resident orcas, nor seems rationally enforceable. Neither option takes into consideration the loss of valuable experiential education that would occur under a seasonal moratorium. Working through both traditional and experiential education platforms myself, I can tell you from personal experience that there is a stark contrast between those that passively learn about the southern residents and those that respectfully experience them. Not only do I see this contrast in students and adults alike, but I became the educator and advocate that I am today because of the first experience I had with southern residents years ago from a whale watching vessel. I'm a native Floridian, and before that tour, I lacked the complex cultural context pertaining to West Coast orcas. I was not even aware that a community was endangered and struggling. So this was my first experience with any wild orcas, and experiencing J-POD as a large family unit was an absolutely unparalleled experience. Partnering the experience with an educated naturalist on board equipped me with knowledge and references, which started a process that changed everything about how I live my life, where I live, my job, my consumer habits, my impacts on the natural world at every turn. I dare say I'm not the only one with this story. And while some may think that the same experience is achievable solely from land, they forget that if no one had been there to tell me the southern resident's story, I would not have come away with the same understanding nor the same connection to spark the advocacy and work that came afterward. I'm proposing 3 commercial whale watch boats within a group of southern residents, year-round viewing, weather conditions permitting, and a 2-hour interim pause on the days that southern residents are present to allow researchers the ability to collect data on the sentinel effect of whale watching vessels. Thank you.
Amanda, thank you for your comments today. Nikki, next, please.
Okay, it looks like Todd has got his sound figured out. Todd, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me now?
Yep, we can hear you.
Great. Thank you, Commissioners. My name is Todd Haas, Special Assistant to the Director at the Puget Sound Partnership and former Chair of the Vessels Working Group for the Task Force. I'll focus on 2 points and hope to clarify which potential sentinel benefits are a misconception or premature and which could become real. Please note that the partnership submitted a letter supporting option B that is much more comprehensive and detailed. First, the Washington State Academy of Sciences cited my preliminary analysis of soundwatch data in asserting the lack of evidence for a sentinel effect. An earlier comment from the industry referred you to a statistic from the 2019 soundwatch report, a graph that shows the total number of infractions or incidents like speeding and close approaches decreases with an increasing number of commercial whale watching vessels, and they conclude that this demonstrates the sentinel effects of their boats. That conclusion is too simplistic and it's incorrect. The reason that the total number of incidents go down as the number of vessels go up is due to unequal sampling effort. You have to look at rates and not totals. Rates adjust for the differences in sampling effort. My deeper look at the Soundwatch data on rates show that generally when the number of industry vessels increases near both southern residents and transient orcas, the rate of speeding incidents and close approaches goes up approximately doubling or more, causing more disturbance and noise than when 0 to a few commercial vessels are present. So the partnership urges you to make sure that the final rule limits the number of commercial vessels to 1 in a modified version of option B. We appreciate that the industry tries to intervene and sound their horns or contact vessels by radio when boaters break the rules. But at this point, the scientists in the academy have advised extreme precaution and advocated for a minimal number of industry vessels around the southern residents. Finally, thinking more holistically, the proposed rules would allow the industry to report sightings of southern residents to the Whale Report Alert System. This would fill a real-time knowledge gap to help reduce the noise footprint of shipping and ferries on orcas in Puget Sound. While we may debate other aspects of the industry's potential to provide sentinel benefits to southern residents, the value of having a single commercial vessel in an opportunistic lookout role to systematically alert shipping, ferries, and the Navy and other maritime professionals to the presence of southern residents
especially outside the San Juan Islands in fall, would be a unique and significant win-win opportunity. Thank you for your patience in connecting me to the meeting.
Todd, thank you for your comments today. Nikki?
Yeah, I just want to reiterate that we still have another 15 people in the queue. We're getting some traffic about people being concerned that they're not going to get to speak because you mentioned the last call comment. So everybody that has their hands up, you are going to get a chance to speak. We still have a bit of ways to go. So our next person is Whitney Neubauer, followed by Jeff Friedman. Go ahead, Whitney.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the commission, for the opportunity to comment today. My name is Whitney Neubauer, and I'm the director of Whale Scout, a Washington State nonprofit. One of our primary programs is land-based whale watching. Empowering and inspiring the public to preserve and advocate these animals will lead to recovery, as David Bain explained earlier. The commercial licensing rules ultimately need to focus on the foraging success of the whales and the ability to be enforced. The proposed rules include many variables that make enforcement problematic. From designating watchable groups of whales on the water with fluid travel patterns to the varying number of vessels allowed in different seasons, it will be difficult to track in real time and enforce which vessels under which licenses that view separate groups of whales during one time slot are not viewing whales later in the day. It also forces companies to decide which passengers will see southern residents and which ones will not. Whale Scout would like to offer the alternative of 3 commercial vessels per group of southern residents throughout the year and follow current Be Whale Wise Pacific Whale Watching operators operating procedures. Changes to current commercial operations can have significant implications for private boater behavior, which could be detrimental, including high-speed incidents and strikes. The sentinel role of the professional operators needs to be better understood prior to making significant changes. This is a precautionary approach. A flexible research opportunity window should be coordinated between researchers and commercial operators for research to be conducted on boater behavior without the presence of commercial vessels. This would allow for the sentinel role to be studied and better understood. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today.
Thank you, Whitney, for your comments. Next, Nikki.
Next, we've got Jeff Friedman, followed by Ariel Youssef. Go ahead, Jeff.
Thank you, commissioners. My name is Jeff Friedman. I'm the operator of Maya's Legacy Whale Watching in Friday Harbor, and I represent the Pacific Whale Watch Association. I was also a member of Governor Inslee's Orca Task Force and served on the department's advisory panel for commercial whale watch licensing. I've seen firsthand how these processes can get derailed by those who have an anti-whale watching agenda and confuse the issues of southern resident recovery and the precautionary principle to the point of adding restrictions that end up being harmful to southern residents. This is an issue that's very important to southern residents, and it's important that we get this right. The 2019 legislation that we supported created very precautionary whale watching regulations for southern residents in Washington waters, including an approach distance that's 3 times the global standard for whale watching viewing distances and a slow speed zone to reduce sound around whales. We also support the legislation's authorization to create this licensing program. I do need to express that in working with the department, we haven't felt heard specifically on the nature of our shared waterways and the reality of our daily experience on the water. Our primary concern is that the proposed rules are not in the best interest of the southern residents and will increase vessel impacts. For most of the time, the vast majority of the time of the year, we will be the only vessels prohibited from the vicinity of southern residents, preventing us from being able to offer these whales the benefits to research, public education, conservationally, and most importantly, our ability to help reduce impacts from other vessels in our increasingly shared waterways. As someone who's on the water most of the year, I spend so much time on our tours contacting private boaters, ferries, and large ships on a daily basis on the radio, by waving flags, by sounding horns. Most of them are appreciative that we're giving them the heads up that they can slow down and transit around the whales. I see firsthand for anyone that doubts the Sentinel effect, I invite them to stand next to me at the helm and see how much we are reducing vessel impacts out there for each one of these boats that we alter course. We're asking for the commission to reconsider the direction of the proposed rules and develop a standard licensing program and not adopt the time, day, and month viewing restrictions that will remove our precautionary and protective and beneficial presence for the southern residents. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff, for your comments today. Next, Nikki.
Okay, next is Ariel Weissef, followed by Amy Eberlein. Ariel, please correct me because I'm pretty sure I said your last name.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you all for having me. My name is Ariel Weissef. I'd just like to start out by saying I strongly agree with what's been previously said by Amanda Colbert, Whitney, Monica, Jeff, and David Bain. My paying job is as a nurse, but I'm a volunteer naturalist for Whale Scout. I do not work for a whale watching company as I am a shore-based naturalist. I became a naturalist because I was inspired by the naturalists Melissa and Jerusha on the Whale Watch boat Odyssey when they introduced me to Granny and Mega back in 2014. I now spend roughly 5 hours a week on shore educating people in Puget Sound about the southern residents. I am concerned by the increase in reckless behavior of private boats when whale watch boats are not present. I was at Point Robinson on November 28th, just a few days ago, when J-Pod passed by. The whale watch boat Saratoga was on scene and following the Be Whale Wise guidelines when a private boat was speeding up to the whales. The private boats noticed the whales and the Saratoga and then emulated Saratoga's correct behavior. Once Saratoga left and the whales continued into Tacoma, there were private boats motoring up to the whales. One was within 20 feet of J-26 Mike and did not shut their motor off. I'm also concerned by the potential data that will be lost if whale watch boats are not on the water. The birth of new babies J-57 and J-58 were first reported by research or by whale watch boats to the researchers. I was a private passenger myself aboard the Saratoga on July 6th when I myself witnessed the ferry strike and kill a young humpback whale named Chip. The crew of the Saratoga radioed both ferries ahead of time as a warning, but one of them did not heed the warning and ultimately killed Chip. I personally filmed his final breath as he died. If the whale watch boat had not been there, we never would have known that this happened. It's important to note that the Saratoga was with Chip that day because they voluntarily adhered to the time limit on viewing orcas and had left the orcas alone in Puget Sound. The whale watch boats want to do right by the whales, and I think that shutting them out to reduce the noise level by just 0.6% will do more harm than good. I personally hope you'll allow for 3 whale watch boats per group year-round in a 2-hour break period to seriously study the research on the sentinel role of whale watch boats. Some people have said here today that there's no data supporting the sentinel role of whale watch boats, and that's simply because it has not been seriously studied. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ariel, for your comments today. Nikki, next, please.
Next, we've got Amy Eberlein, followed by Cindy Hansen. Go ahead, Amy.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Hi, my name is Amy Eberlein. Thank you, commissioners, for your service and time today. For the sake of time, I agree with Aaron Glass, David Bain, Monica Whelan-Shields, Amanda Colbert, Whitney Neuberger, Jeff Friedman, Ariel, and Cindy's to come. I'm the founder and executive director of a nonprofit in Anacortes called the Salish Sea School. I'm the captain and co-teacher aboard our small group student program that aims to create student leaders in marine conservation by taking them out on the water. The Salish Sea School firmly believes in the power of safely experiencing marine wildlife to create an advocate. I reviewed all the commissioners' backgrounds and biographies and was thrilled to see everyone's love for the outdoors from fishing to volcano climbing. I thank you for being active advocates for environment. I'm betting your love and willingness to serve as a commissioner for our local environment most likely started with an unforgettable outdoor experience. So we can all agree, experience is the number one item in life to produce an advocate. This is indeed how it started with me, viewing a southern resident pod oh so long ago aboard a whale watching boat. That experience led me down to the road of southern resident advocacy and inspired me to create our place-based on-the-water marine conservation school. This past summer, I saw it firsthand with my students, so we took 6 small groups of students on the water, Of the six groups, two groups were lucky enough to see and experience a southern residence. They saw the cuddle puddles, they heard their calls, identified their saddle patches, and matched them to their names. Now these students have a greater desire to protect them. These students know just how much we have to lose if this population goes extinct. They wrote letters to government officials with much greater vigor than the groups that didn't get to see the southern residents. They have greater interest to get involved in salmon restoration efforts and water quality projects. I'd also like to discuss the utmost professionalism and care that I've experienced and seen while previously working for a whale watching company and working with them this past summer. They really get a bad rep because of a few bad experiences people have seen. These companies are continually alerting large vessels and small recreation boats about the presence of any whales, especially the southern residents on the west side. I truly believe both option A and B would greatly reduce the opportunity for trained and professional operators to be on the water to help alert other vessels. I hope a new solution can be brought forth to provide a net ecological benefit that David Bain suggested. I recommend year-round viewing, but significantly reduce vessel amounts from unlimited to 3 per group. This is precautionary. Ensure funding of more marine patrols and even increase cost for violations for those that violate the rules. Please consider the fact that if there are claims there's no science for sentinel actions, the same should be considered for whale-watching vessels being magnets. The science is not there yet, and more study needs to occur. Finally, when deciding how to allow access to purchase or apply for a license, I'd like to request a thoughtful process that would enable everyone a fair chance, including our small nonprofit school. I also want to mention my concern that the Small Business Economic Impact Study did not include the other companies that are now going to be required to obtain an incidental whale watching license, such as our nonprofit and the other small businesses, and perhaps pay for AIS. Don McIsaac, I want to thank you for your wonderful questions earlier. The JASCO report discussed the soundscape in the Salish Sea. 66% of the sound is produced by ferries, and it says 0.6% whale-watching vessels. Thank you for your time.
Amy, thank you very much for your comments today. Nikki, next, please.
Next is Cindy Hansen, followed by Janet Thomas. Go ahead, Cindy.
Hi, my name is Cindy Hansen, and I'm the education coordinator for the nonprofit Orca Network. We agree with the earlier comments regarding the benefits of professional whale watching and the lack of supporting science to justify the proposed rules, and we add the following. We are supportive of a licensing system for whale watching and participated in this process from the beginning, but we do not support either of the options in the draft rules, as they are essentially a moratorium for much of the year. The concept of a moratorium is one that the legislature already discussed during the 2019 session and ultimately rejected. Not allowing commercial whale watching with southern residents poses a risk by removing the trained professionals. The whale watching community plays a valuable role by relaying the presence of whales to military vessels and ferries, and they are sometimes the only boats available to collect sightings data and ID photos, which they share with researchers. This important information will be lost if they are restricted from viewing southern residents. The draft rules do not recognize the sentinel role that whale watching vessels play, and they do not incorporate anecdotal evidence. I personally live on San Juan Island and spend hours watching the southern resident orcas from shore, and I have witnessed whale watching boats repeatedly reaching out to recreational boaters by sounding their horns or sometimes providing a physical barrier between oncoming boats and whales when no enforcement or monitoring boats are present. We urge the commission to adopt a rule allowing 3 whale watching boats per group of southern resident orcas year round with a 2-hour research opportunity, as described earlier by Whitney Negebauer and Amanda Colbert. The current draft rules were created based on a recommendation to use the precautionary principle. Given that recreational vessels are responsible for the vast majority of recorded incidents, the precautionary principle will be achieved by allowing whale watching vessels to be present with southern resident orcas, provide an educational and protective role. Also, just in closing, I would like to add that this licensing process has further divided our community of organizations and individuals who should all be combining efforts to restore salmon and provide increased prey for southern residents. The professional whale watching community is not the enemy. They are allies who care about the southern resident orcas as much as we all do. And by working collaboratively with them on salmon recovery efforts, we have the opportunity to make a real difference for these whales. Thank you for the opportunity to comment, and Orca Network has submitted much more detailed comments in writing.
Cindy, thank you very much for your comments today. Nikki?
Next is Janet Thomas, followed by Lavelle Pratt. Go ahead, Janet.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Thank you very much. I am the executive director of Orca Relief Citizens Alliance, and it's an organization that was founded in 1997 when Mark Anderson, the founder, witnessed the orca, the southern residents, being trapped in Dyes Inlet. They were in search of salmon, and he made the immediate connection that they were facing a shortage of food, and he started the Orca Relief in order to save them. It is really, I live on San Juan Island. I've lived here for 30 years. I was the manager of the San Juan County Park when we banned jet ski whale watching from launching at our parks. That ended up in the court and ended up being decided by Washington State Supreme Court that we actually had the right to do that. I used to spend hours sitting on the west side watching the southern residents rest, play, and feed in the kelp beds on the west side of the island. Like many, many other residents that live here, we can no longer go out and do that because it is too painful to watch the invasion of whale-watching boats that trap them, that get in their way of accessing those kelp beds and their familiar areas, and they are an absolute sentinel to other recreational boats in the area. It has been heartbreaking as a human being in facing the tremendous challenges we have on this planet, fighting profit for the sake of life on the planet. And this is exactly what's going on here. We're talking about money being more important than saving a very sacred species. This is one of the most advanced marine mammals on the planet. They have a very sophisticated language. They stay with their families. And why did we see a mother orca carry her dead baby around for many, many days in a state of mourning? My question is, why did we see a photograph of the mother carrying her dead baby? Why were there photographers right there? And they were connected to the whale watch industry. How do we know that that kind of invasion wasn't the reason that that baby died? That there was no way there could be communication between that baby and the mother? We need to give the animals that are facing extinction, these marine mammals that have been sacred to our native peoples for thousands of years, and we see them as a commodity. And that's a sign, a tragic sign of these times. And I would really greatly appreciate seeing a suspension of whale watching of the southern residents until they are no longer facing extinction. The industry has indicated that it does not impact them financially in any way. So why can't they be the heroes in this situation and support the life, the ongoing life of the southern resident orcas? Thank you.
Thank you, Janet, for your comments. Next, Nikki.
Next, we've got Lavelle Pratt, followed by Joe Scardino. Go ahead, Lavelle.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Lavelle Pratt, and I'm the Marine Protection and Policy Director at Friends of the San Juans. I'll begin with a quote from your excellent strategic plan. The department must demonstrate bold leadership in conservation, recovery, science, and management in order to better achieve its mission. Southern resident orcas are the most widely recognized species of greatest conservation need, both here in Washington State and worldwide. Your bold leadership is required to address the conservation needs of the southern residents. This rulemaking is not a situation where DFW is challenged by having a broad mandate yet limited direct authority and technical assistance capacity. The legislature has given you the direct authority to address the conservation needs of the critically endangered southern residents by establishing this licensing program. WDFW has also received the technical assistance capacity needed to fulfill this mandate, best available science from the science panel, and an independent economic analysis that determined that this rulemaking will not pose a viability concern to the industry. As you've heard, the best available science clearly states that a precautionary approach is needed to address the conservation needs of southern residents. The best available science and the economic analysis both support the Southern Resident Orca Task Force Recommendation 28 to suspend the viewing of southern residents. Friends of the San Juan strongly supports a suspension. Friends of the San Juans could support option A as filed if the number of commercial whale watch boats are reduced from 3 to 1. The Seattle Aquarium, Mayor Will Hall, and others have addressed the need to reduce the number of commercial whale watch boats from 3 to 1, so I won't go into that. I do want to thank staff for their explanation that a pregnant whale could be identified as vulnerable via emergency rule once WDFW has reliable data about a confirmed pregnancy, and thereby prohibit the viewing of groups of southern residents that include confirmed pregnant whales. Friends of the San Juans maintains that the rule should include a provision about low visibility conditions. We recognize that visibility conditions can vary from place to place within the Salish Sea, and that this provision in the rule could be difficult to enforce. However, the viewing of southern residents in low visibility conditions would impede compliance with state law, distance, and speed requirements. WDFW should prohibit this unsafe practice in the rule and make every effort at enforcement. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lavelle, for your comments. Next, Nikki, please.
Next, we've got Joe Scordino, followed by Kenneth Balcom. Go ahead, Joe.
Thank you, Commissioners. My name is Joe Scordino. Some of you may know me from my pre-retirement position as the Deputy Regional Administrator of NOAA Fisheries. I've kind of tried to stay away from management issues so I could enjoy retirement, but it seems like I'm ending up volunteering to help on various issues, including serving on WDFW's advisory committee on this whale watching issue. I sent written comments, so I'll be short here. It's obvious to me that commercial whale watching vessels have played a significant role in the southern residents abandoning their historic feeding grounds in Puget Sound, concurrent with the serious decline in the status of this endangered species. The recent Washington Academy of Sciences report confirms the vessel disturbance is preventing the southern residents from finding and catching what salmon are available in Puget Sound. Studies have determined that the lack of salmon is driving the decline of the of the southern residents. So it's obvious that we need to do something to greatly reduce the disturbance that's going on in Puget Sound. It seems to me it's tragic that the commission has taken all the efforts to reduce salmon fisheries. Fishermen have made sacrifices. Hatchery production has been increased. And all of that's going to be the knot if we don't reduce vessel impacts on the southern residents when they're in Puget Sound. I'll limit my comments on the whale watch industry's rhetoric about sentinel role, because I think others have addressed that well. But I do want to say I personally observed the commercial whale watch vessels playing this magnet role where it attracts multiple recreational vessels to where the whales are, increasing the disturbance and thus preventing the whales from feeding. And that's what we need to push for, is we need to provide these whales an opportunity to catch the fish that are being made available for them.
We're at time, Joe.
Thanks.
Mr. Scordino, one moment, please. Commissioner McIsaac has a question.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Joe, thanks very much for the testimony and serving on the advisory body and putting your comments in writing. Other than that one four-letter word, it was some excellent testimony there. But your recommendation is for option A with some twists on increasing enforcement. And I don't know if there's a short answer to that. If there's a long answer, I think we'd be very interested in what that is. But if there's a short answer, Maybe you could describe what you meant by that.
On that one specifically, I think the reference to groups, that the allowing three vessels per group of southern resident whales, and the group is defined on a distance measurement. I don't see that as enforceable, because these whales will either spread out or come together in an area, and you could have, you know, 20 to 30 boats around them, and there's no way to enforce that. The better way would be to refer to the pod, which is kind of the biological unit of the whales, and limit the three vessels observing to the pods as they come into Puget Sound, regardless of whether they're spread out or in small groups.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Scordino. Next, Nikki, please.
Next is Kenneth Balcom, followed by Susan Anderson. Go ahead, Kenneth.
Unmute. Am I unmuted?
You're unmuted.
Okay. Thank you, everybody, for participating in this hearing. In 1976, when I began my study, following Dr. Mike Biggs' study, of the southern resident killer whale population, I was real proud of being a whale biologist, and I would talk about this with people on the streets and in the marinas. And the most universal response was, well, what good are they? My answer at the time and still is that they are the indicators of the health of this Salish Sea ecosystem. And we know now that they depend upon salmon. And I knew from the beginning of the study that salmon were a big commercial interest in the state. WDFW managed the salmon fisheries until NOAA took over management following the Bolt decision. And basically, I heard the fisheries, the Washington fisheries biologists, being very concerned about the fact that there was, the NOAA folks were basically giving away the fish. There was fishing every day. I was on the west side of San Juan Island from 1976 on, and every day from May to September, there were commercial fishing boats. Every night there were commercial fishing boats. Everywhere we went around Puget Sound and in Canada, Strait of Georgia, there were recreational fishing boats as well. Fishing was what was going on. There were 1.5 to 1.9 million Chinook salmon averaging 22 pounds caught every year that came through the Strait of Juan de Fuca. On the Washington side, on the DFO side, they didn't know how many, but it was probably half to as many. Anyway, the issue, I really appreciate everybody's concern about the southern resident killer whales. They are on a track to extinction. It is going to happen. And it's, unless you feed them, there's no way that any regulation you have about a vessel, about a noise, about any activity is going to save these whales. The only way is to increase the number of preferably native run Chinook salmon and the other species. They'll eat chum in the fall. I've seen them eat other stuff, but basically salmon recovery has got to be your big thing. And unfortunately, it's in competition with our other commerce. Thank you.
Mr. Balcom, thanks for your comments again today. Next, Nikki.
Next, we've got Susan Anderson, followed by Toby Cooper. Go ahead, Susan.
Hi, I'm Susan Anderson, and I'd actually like to know if I may release my time so that Ken Balcom can finish his talk, his comments, please.
That would be fine.
Thank you.
Did we lose Ken?
No, let me find him. I maybe lost him.
We can go on to someone else and he can get back on if that is an option for him.
He's on the bottom.
Okay, here we go. Go ahead, Ken.
I will unmute. Okay, thank you very much. Well, yeah, I wanted to really, I'm amazed at the, and gratified at the interest in saving these whales. These are dear to me. They're my family. There's much of what I enjoy about this earth as anything, even other people. So what I would like to see is effective use of our tax money and our political and bureaucratic efforts to save these whales. It's, you know, NOAA agrees with me that they have a longer timeline on when they're going to go extinct. But basically right now, J-POD is the only saving grace we have in the southern resident killer whale population. We can look at the other, K-POD hadn't had a baby in 10 years. L-POD, many matrilines in that pod are already biologically extinct. There is no potential reproduction. The only thing we have is J-POD that offers us any opportunity. And they're the ones that come around. So let's, yeah, protect them, save them from vessel interference, do everything else, but most of all, feed them. Restore the salmon ecosystem for the benefit of the whales and the fishermen. Now we know what good they are. They're good to our well-being in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Nikki, next, please.
Next, we've got Toby Cooper, followed by Elisa Lemire Brooks. Go ahead, Toby.
Thanks, and thank you for letting Ken go there. He's obviously an icon of the, you know, the keystone of a lot of the work that gets done for the orca. So I'm as much of an advocate for the orca as anybody in the room here. But I have a little comment here that's kind of a piece of this puzzle that I don't think has really been addressed. It's just an item that I think bears a little bit further consideration. Missing, in my view, is any kind of analysis of the Whale Watch customers, who they are and why do they decide to spend the money they do to go on these boats. I would submit that the Whale Watch operators are not really in the Whale Watch business. They're in the entertainment business. I've done a lot of trips with these guys, take advantage of their frequent flyer kind of things. And, you know, at least pre-pandemic, would go out all the time with friends and sometimes just alone spontaneously. And I'd spend as much time kind of watching the people as I did the wildlife. And it's kind of my observation that, you know, a couple of things. First of all, people just absolutely love these trips. And secondly, that they're happy consumers of whatever they find out there, be it humpbacks or minkies or stellar sea lions or birds. And certainly the southern residents and the orca are part of the conversation. But if you don't see the southern residents out there, it's not a deal killer. And I'd like to see more representation of that element in this, preferably from some kind of independent survey, you know, source, not the operators themselves, but somebody that did some kind of surveys as to why people go on these trips and what do they get out of it. And I suspect you would find, as some others have alluded to here, that people would come away from that as, you know, essentially voters for the whales too. So that part of it, I think, is very strong. So, you know, if it came down to a suspending, as Lovell Pratt said, I'm part of that organization, so I stand by her comments. That's probably not a bad way to go. And frankly, I think that the impact on the whale watch boats would be really minimal because people are going to take those trips anyway. So that's it. Thanks very much.
Thank you for your comments today, Toby. Nikki, next, please.
Next is Elisa, followed by Peter Henke. Go ahead, Elisa. Where's Alyssa?
Hi. Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Thank you, Chair and members of the Commission, for the opportunity to comment today. My name is Elisa Lemire Brooks, a citizen of Shoreline, and I'm the Whale Sighting Network Coordinator for Orca Network, a Whidbey-based nonprofit dedicated to connecting people to the whales of our area, Pacific Northwest. And we've been working for decades to raise awareness and educate on the importance of safe and healthy habitats for the southern residents. Through our Whale Sighting Network, we help document the southern residents throughout their range with the emphasis on their fall forays into Puget Sound proper. I am in support of a licensing program that keeps the southern residents safe and am in support of comments made earlier by Cindy, Monica, David, Amanda, and others, and the alternative proposal presented by Whitney. The well-being of J46 Star and her endangered clan of salmon-eating orcas is first and foremost my priority. From the whale's perspective, what will be the noticeable net benefit to the southern residents by removing certain boats from their habitat that is filled with hundreds of vessels who have little to no experience around the whales? Commercial Whale Watch Operators is a partner in drafting Be Whale Wise regulation guidelines and have voluntarily adapted over the years with a significant reduction in the past two. On vessel noise, the JASCO report tells us that Commercial Whale Watch is responsible for just 0.6% of the overall noise generated by vessels. Proposals A and B removes trained licensed captains who know how to safely navigate and share these waters with extremely spread out southern residents, often 6 to 8 groups of 1 to 3 whales spread great distances in all directions. There are nearly 250,000 registered boats in Washington state, including recreational and hundreds of fishing boats, high speed passenger ferries, many of who have no knowledge that Salish Sea is home to whales, let alone an endangered species. A precautionary approach would be up to 3 licensed commercial whale watch boats year-round at current approach distances, with windows of research opportunities where no commercial whale watch boats would be viewing southern residents, and the sentinel role effect could be studied. Long-term net benefits to the southern residents, where commercial whale watch captains and naturalists participate. I and many have with regularity witnessed crews intercept high-speed wreck boats barreling towards very spread-out southern residents in Puget Sound and Harrow Strait. As science panel states, they cannot prove sentinel role, but they cannot disprove it either, and testimony of trained, experienced shore-based and other observers should not be ignored. A study on the effect of commercial whale watch boats around southern residents has been included in this license process. While it's useful, it is outdated. Long-term benefits to the southern residents that are at risk. Contributions of robust data including pod presence, IDs, presence of new calves, and shifting foraging patterns due to the decimation of salmon runs all throughout southern resident range. This data helps inform science, advocacy, and public policy, including the task force and this process here. Educating thousands, a role which has an immediate impact and educates the next generation of allies who will take action and who will be taking the lead on recovery of the southern residents. And for the record, we and many other organizations who have been accused of taking money from the Whale Watch Association does not receive any money. So this comment is of my own love and appreciation of these whales we all care about, and people need to stop talking disparagingly about their names and dividing the community. It's like not of any help to this community of critically endangered orcas. Everyone here cares about these orcas. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your comments today, Elisa. Next, Nikki, please.
Next, we got Peter Henke, followed by Butch Smith. Go ahead, Peter.
Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Peter Henke. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this afternoon. I am a Port Townsend commissioner, as well as the owner of Puget Sound Express. We're the oldest whale watch company. We started in 1985, and we are one of the largest whale watch companies as well. We operate 2 boats in Edmonds, Washington, and 2 boats in Port Townsend. Our range is at any time from Harstein Island, something like Harstein Island, to Susha Island, and out to Souk, which is west of Grace Rock. So we actually do cover a very large range of the Salish Sea. I have over 30,000 hours of on the water experience watching killer whales, specifically watching the resident orcas. And just a couple comments, because everything has really been said. I think it is important to note about the JASCO report that whale watch boats, in light of everything else making noise on the Puget Sound, represent about 0.6% of the noise. It's also important to note that, commissioners, you really should visualize what 300 yards is and 7 knots. So if we are 3 football fields away from the whales and we're traveling at 7 knots, and that, let's put yourself in Puget Sound, you're actually quite a ways away from the southern resident orcas. And I will guarantee you, because I do it all the time, there are many, many, many other boats that are between us and the southern residents, which have no idea that the whales are there, and they're traveling at 20 to 30 knots, depending on where they're going and the size and type of their vessel. So I think it's really naive to say that the bad whale watch boats are making a lot of noise and they're jumping on top of the whales when we're actually 3 football fields away from the whales and moving at a very slow rate of speed. Our vessels are multi-engine vessels. Generally, we have 1 engine on at an idle. We have all the electronics off. We're doing what we're supposed to do. Just a couple comments. The Joe Scardino comment about the whale watch boats chasing the whales away. Actually, I disagree with that. It is the salmon. We now know that J-Pod and the rest of the southern residents spend most of their time on the west side of Vancouver Island, where there are plentiful salmon and large salmon. So we actually don't see the residents in here very often. And I do agree with Toby Cooper. We are in the entertainment business. That's obvious. And, you know, it is an economic hardship to not see the southern residents, but it's not the end of the world. We do have lots of other whales to look at and lots of other wildlife to look at. But I do strongly disagree that we can't provide a benefit to helping these whales get through the waters by being sentinels out there. We were at Point Defiance that day that Rob talked about with J-Pod and lots of other boats. Our captains were working full time with horns, flags, positioning the vessel to alert all the other boats that have no idea that the whales are there, that the residents are coming down Vashon Island and turning the corner at Point Defiance. These actions go on all the time. We were on scene when the Washington State Ferry hit, struck, and killed a humpback. It was actually my son that tried to alert the ferry boat that the humpback was in its course. Unfortunately, no one was on the ferry in the wheelhouse to be able to turn the boat and stop it from hitting that humpback. So I really urge you to think carefully about this sentinel role and how important it is, not just to the southern residents, but to all whales in the Salish Sea that were out there on the water alerting people to the existence that these whales are in their area. Thank you very much for your time, and I appreciate you taking this into consideration.
Peter, thank you for your comments today. Next, Nikki, please.
Next, we got Butch Smith, followed by Ron Gardner. Go ahead, Butch.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Butch Smith. I'm a port commissioner at the Port of El Waco. President of the El Waco Charter Association, and sit on the PFMC Management Council. And I also was on the governor's whale task force. And I think there needs to be a shout out to the governor for setting that task force up. It brought a lot of people together that otherwise would never know one another, and working relationships and even friendships that came out of that, to recognize that we all have a stake in this process. We all have a stake in recovery of orca whales, and that you know, this is a big puzzle, and we all have to step forward to put the pieces together. We did make a rather huge decision on the west coast from Nea Bay to the southern California coast on salmon, on what we would do if numbers of Chinook salmon fell under 1 million fish. I'm not going to go into that. I sent you the commissioners that. But I will say that, you know, this is, I'm not going to tell you whether to pick A, B, C, or D, but I will tell you this, that there are a lot of passionate people on this call, and including industries, and including, you know, there people like Donna Sandstrom and everybody that spoke. But the crucial thing is what we decide or not decide today is all well and good if it's not followed up by money. And I will tell you, people on this call and else, if we do not follow this up in January by supporting WDF&W's full budget to implement salmon recovery, habitat, patrol. The reason that you didn't see a lot of patrol officer, WDF officers out there is plain and simple. They do not have the money to get a full complement of officers where they're needed. And unfortunately, you know, people in Olympia, in the Senate and the House like to use WDF&W as a hostage or extortion. And, it's going to take us all together here to take this passion and go down to Olympia. Well, I guess we can't go down there. However, we're going to do it and let people like Senator Vanderway and Senator Solomon and others know how important, funding WDF&W so they can do what they need to do to help the southern, resident killer whales. And so I'm pretty much gonna leave it at that. And I don't envy, you know, your commissioner's decision on this. There's really a lot of right and not much wrong. And that's what makes the decision the most toughest. And so I want to thank you, and I want to thank everybody for their passion on Save Us. The fishermen on the West Coast too stepped up to the plate, and we want to do our part, and we expect other people, you know, just not the whale watching community, the pollution, you know, the development, vessel noise, all of those pieces have to step forward and do what we can to save these whales. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Butch, thank you for your comments as always. I know the next one is Ron Garner. I heard his name again.
Yeah, go ahead, Ron.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay. Yes, I'm Ron Garner. I'm also on the ORCA task force and worked with many of our cohorts on there that have been on here speaking today, and we all have a passion for the orcas. And as Butch said, I agree totally with everything that Mr. Smith said previously, and also what Kenneth Balcom said about feeding the orcas being the big problem. But I'm going to say the same thing as Butch did, and that is I'm not going to pick A, B, or C. I'm going to leave that up to you with all these hard decisions you're making. But I do want to thank the commission extremely for carrying on trying to make more fish for the orcas. We've been fighting this battle for a long time, and we came out with that at the ORCA task force as being one of the big problems. So we have cut a lot of fishing back. We've put fish on for salmon for the orcas through the Pacific Salmon Treaty and through the Pacific Management Council. And we want to continue to make fish. I don't know if any of you saw that our orcas went down to California where they have a robust hatchery program in the Chinook. Were really big. There was one of the high spots of the year was the West Coast in California. We got to get back to some kind of level to feed these fish, as Ken said, or they're not going to be here. But anyway, I'm going to leave the part of the decision making to you, but everybody does need to do their part. And I feel like the fishermen have done our part, and we want to see these orcas thrive. We don't want to see them go extinct on our watch. So thank you to everyone.
Ron, thank you for your comments. Nikki, next.
Next, we've got Tamara Kelly, followed by, I know Susan Anderson did speak before, so I don't know what she needs to say because she gave up her time for Ken. But we'll go from there. Go ahead, Tamara.
All right. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. So, hello. Thank you for having me today. My name is Tamara Kelly, and I'm the board president of Orchid Conservancy. I'd like to start off by stating that I oppose the proposed guidelines as written, as they are not founded in modern science, and I do not believe that they will benefit the whales in any capacity. I would like to call my support to Dr. Dave Bain, Ken Balcom, Monica Kelly, and then all the members of the PWWA who have made a comment today. I want to echo what they've already said while providing a few additional observations that I've experienced in my time land-based and boat-based whale watching. As you all know, we have two populations of orcas that frequent the Salish Sea. I think it's worth noting that the mammal-eating population of orcas are exposed to the same toxins and vessel noise as the residents, yet their population is thriving. The major and obvious difference is the prey availability, and arguably the transient population has more difficult prey to hunt, where vessel noise could potentially be more disruptive. However, this population is doing well, which directly supports Ken's call to allocate time and money into salmon restoration. The other point I would like to mention on the sentinel role of whale watching is the NOAA-approved military takes on 51 approved takes of wildlife, and this includes the endangered resident orcas. I acknowledge there are varying levels of the takes. However, in my experience in orca conservation, I know the military is willing and responsive and cooperative to work with us conservation groups and pausing exercises when they are aware of animals being present. So our whale watch vessels have been crucial in reporting to the military and other large vessels like ferries and cargo ships the whereabouts to ensure the safety and the protection of the animals, and I've firsthand seen this work. So that is all I have for you guys today. Again, thank you so much for your time and letting me make a comment.
Thank you, Tamara, for your comments today. Nikki, you have one more.
Okay. I've got Tim Reagan, and that's it. Let's see. Go ahead, Tim.
Okay. Tim Reagan. I don't consider either of these options to be sufficiently protective and far-sighted. They both, in my mind, give the benefit of doubt to the whale watchers, and in my view will contribute to further decline. The science on this issue is pretty clear. Whale watching interferes with southern resident killer whale behavior, leading to a cascade of effects on whale health, reproduction, and survival, and population trend. The economics, I think, are also clear that the industry doesn't depend on watching this population. There are five things that I guess I'd ask you to keep in mind as you go through this process. One is the issue of control, or really the lack thereof. We cannot control killer whale behavior. We can only control ourselves. And this population is in great need of conservation, which is a willingness to limit our own behavior so that other species may persist. You've heard the term precaution used a number of times today, and our lives are filled with decisions that are aimed at protecting us from future hazards. That is the essence of insurance, of preventative care, of regular maintenance. Can we not treat these whales with similar care? The term adaptive management hasn't been used often today, but it should be. We need an adaptive management approach that helps us resolve important uncertainties so that we make better decisions in the future. Let's be more structured in our approach, because otherwise we are fiddling while Rome burns. Enforcement, you've heard a lot about today. And your decisions will be meaningless if they are not adequately enforced. You're hearing a lot about the so-called sentinel effect. And while the whale watchers consider themselves protectors of the whales, the industry also has a substantial history of violations, particularly when enforcement has not been present. So I'm at least very skeptical about the protective claims. And finally, time. You're making this decision not just for this generation, those of us here present now, but for future generations as well. The ecosystems they inherit from us depend on your willingness to do the right thing, the far-sighted thing. Over the past 4 years, all of us have had reasons to lose faith in our government institutions. You can help reverse that trend and give us something to be proud of, to support. And that is the grace and care we show to this fragile but ever so magnificent southern resident killer whale population. We are talking about its very persistence. please help us find that kinder, more disciplined, more precautionary path forward. Is that not who we are? So I would advocate strongly for a protective approach that is tied closely to adaptive management so that we are not still arguing the same things 5 or 10 years down the road when the population has declined further. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Reagan, today. That wraps up the open public comment segment.
Hey, Larry.
Yes.
Hold on just a second. Carol Borden has been up and down several times. She hasn't spoke yet.
Okay. Let's go ahead and hear her out, and we'll move on.
Hey, Carol, you're unmuted.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for allowing comments today. My comments will include the following. I endorse Rob Crable from Defenders of Wildlife and Ken Balcom's comments fully today. I advocate for the most restrictive option to save the remaining endangered southern resident orcas. Or option A is a step, but only a step towards reducing commercial whale watching boats from 3-to-1 vessels. In addition, I also advocate for a moratorium on all whale watching for both commercial whale watching vessels and all recreational boaters and recreational fishermen during the times when known orcas are pregnant, giving birth to their calves and rearing them within 8 to 12 months of giving birth in the Salish Sea. Numbers of all vessels need to be limited to fewer and fewer on the Salish Sea to help keep the orcas from being further endangered and dying needlessly via human impacts. I also advocate for Department of Fish and Wildlife to be more proactive on the water during the whale watching season. More DFW wardens need to be in full force during the whale watching season on our waters. Mothers and calves were harassed repeatedly on the Salish Sea and Puget Sound this past year. It was horrific to see. These boaters should have been fined, but no wardens were present. It's unacceptable. In continuing, perhaps a citizen boater volunteer whale watch enforcement training program needs to be established and help in concert with DFW wardens on the water to help enforce regulations to stay away from orcas and other whales in the Salish Sea. I would be happy to be a part of this training, observation, and enforcement program. I also oppose all sonar activities in use by the Navy in the Salish Sea where orcas are known and live and raise their young calves. To take up to 51 whales, orcas, dolphins in the Salish Sea will severely reduce the numbers of orcas and other species that rely on this ecosystem. The FEIS needs to be changed. I also strongly support the development of hybrid Washington ferries that run on electricity and are quiet and that are equipped to observe orcas and all other species of whales via depth fish whale finders on board from being struck, injured, and dying. And a couple more things and I'm done. I also strongly support the removal of all lower Snake River dams to restore Chinook salmon populations as the most preferred food source for orcas and many other species that rely on these salmon for survival. And lastly, that comes to mind and has been on my mind for quite a while is one of our orcas is still imprisoned at Miami Sea Aquarium. Tokate is an endangered southern resident orca who needs to come back home to our Salish Sea after 50 years of captivity for human entertainment trafficking industry. A whale sanctuary is being developed for Tokate off Orcas Island. We need to get her back to be rehabilitated and released back into the Salish Sea and be with her family, Elpod. We all need to do our part to bring her home and all other orcas imprisoned in these chlorinated and concrete tanks. In addition, and finally, this orca will need full support by all of us to once again live in our waters. And this means reduced boating and vessel traffic from whale watching to fishing to recreational boating, sailing. We need to be set up and sacrifice our human desires for the survival of this orca in particular. Let's do what we can that's most beneficial for orcas in the Salish Sea. These endangered orcas and endangered Chinook salmon need our most protection in this fragile ecosystem. And we can do this. We can make this happen. We can be better at this than we have been in the past. And so thank you and have a great day in your decision making.
Thank you, Carol, for your comments. Is that that's the end, Nikki, I assume?
It's the end.
Before I close out for lunch here, Nate, did you want to say anything?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, everybody. Nate Pamplin, Director of Budget and Government Affairs with the Department. Just wanted to note that we're scheduled to come back to you for a decision on your conference call on December 18th. When we write up the summary sheet and prepare your packet, we'll include a couple motions for your all's consideration. One, to consider adopting option A per the recommended adjustments. Another, to adopt option B per our recommended adjustments. But there is another kind of reconfiguration that you would like to consider, especially after you've heard pretty substantial public comments. If we could understand what that is, we could try to help craft what that motion language might look like and be able to include that in your packet for your meeting in a couple weeks.
Okay, I see two hands up, Commissioner McIsaac and then Commissioner Linville, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there could be some healthy discussion amongst commissioners on this whole matter of a feathered option or something like that. So were you intending to go ahead and take a short lunch break and then come back to that? Because if we start on that, I think it could go 20 minutes or more.
Well, I would expect, Don, it's going to go several hours or more. And so, I mean, very candidly, I don't know if we can do that today. We have a lot on our plate. I would say, let me finish, Don. I think that we might have to think about a special session, a special meeting, a virtual meeting one day next week. We've got a lot of very important things on here, including an executive session. So go ahead if you want to comment, and then we'll give Commissioner Linville the floor.
Well, maybe we'll have to pick this up again, but I think before December 18th, I think we ought to have a discussion about all this great public testimony that we heard today. You know, without going into some of the other reasons, I would like to see a modification of option A, maybe of options A and B, to incorporate a couple of things that would enable us to maybe choose them on December 18th. As opposed to somehow that being blocked out. So I got a few ideas here and a few comments. That's where we can take them right now if you want, or we can have a special session later. But, dropping it right now, just not coming back to it and coming in on December 18th and then going into little variations,
I'm not suggesting we drop it. I just, when you say 20 minutes, I don't think that's realistic. Myself, but I'll wait to hear from others. Commissioner Linville?
I would just push really hard for a special session. I have a lot of thoughts on this, and I think it would be irresponsible to make a decision without having another robust conversation with commissioners.
There's also some other related issues to this that haven't come up today, does anybody on the commission not agree with having a virtual meeting, say, next week for a couple hours? Okay.
I totally agree, Larry, with that, coming back for a special session. And I'd like a few minutes then to chime in, because I was on the task force and I sat through 2 years of these meetings, so I can lend my 2 cents worth at that time. Today it's 2 o'clock already.
Yeah, I know it. Okay, we'll do that, Nate. If you and Julie can talk that over, and we'll talk early in the week and get a scheduled set up. Don, did you want to speak?
Well, just because calendar stuff can get so difficult this time of year, if we substituted our December 18th final decision for a discussion about options and some of this other dialogue and pick this up as a final decision on our next meeting, I guess, is January 8th, is there time limits on this that are binding?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner McIsaac, the statute requires us to adopt rules by January 1st. And so we were hoping to have a rule package adopted by you all, and then we would just adopt e-rules that follow your guidance of what you've adopted to cover that bridge period between January 1st and I believe it's January 23, when the rules would go effect if you made a decision on December 18th. So if it's possible, we'll move schedules around and try to accommodate a meeting next week if that's possible for folks.
Any disagreement with that thought?
That's fine.
Okay.
Next week is really difficult for me. I have a whole schedule full of meetings. So just giving a heads up that I'm going to have trouble.
Nate, just to follow up on Commissioner McIsaac's question, if I may, is there any way to get a waiver per his date suggestion to go to have an in-depth discussion on the 18th of December and then a final adoption at our January meeting? I mean, what would we have to do to get some leeway there? Because this is, we've been briefed on this, but today we were briefed and we were inundated with new, very wide variety of information and context that, I, for one, have some catching up to do, and I'm pretty familiar with the issue.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you know, an option that you might consider is, yes, schedule some time to deliberate on option A and B as it pertains to the rules for viewing southern resident killer whales. But there's other elements of the package, the rule package, that you could adopt. And so then I think we've met the legislative intent here of adopting the licensing package. And then we could come up with a schedule to figure out what would be those rules that you would want to shape and ultimately adopt perhaps in January that pertain just to the commercial whale watching viewing of southern residents.
Okay, thank you. I think that being said, if you and Julie could get your heads together early in the week, and then maybe we can put, I don't like the term doodle poll, but we can send it out for a commissioner scheduling considerations. I would welcome that opportunity.
Great. Thank you, sir. We'll put it in motion.
Okay. Before we go to lunch.